Going into submarines.
So I just do it. All right. Open the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Cheyenne, you have some announcements?
I do, thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, three quick announcements. You've probably seen the communications regarding the new recording system. You're going to notice just a couple of differences. There's no longer a flashing mode. When it's recording, it's on. When it's not recording, it's off. And there's a slight delay. Those are the only two changes. Otherwise, we hope it's an improvement for the public to access the meetings. Background briefs, which we update in committee services every couple of years, are done and available. We've distributed one sample to remind everybody and their personal staffs that they're ready, with directions how to navigate to the site. If anybody needs any help finding any of that, just call our office and we'll be able to assist. And a reminder about concept request deadlines for members next Monday. If you want a guaranteed return of your concept by December the 5th. That's it. Thank you.
Great. All right. With that, we're going to open up the informational hearing from the U.S. Department of Justice settlement agreement with the City of Portland. So we have a panel of four. Perfect. Good morning. Thank you for coming. Have you agreed on what, who will be speaking first? Okay, great. So we've had several hearings on this issue. We're just following up on that, see what's happening. And go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you. Can you hear me okay? Is that good? Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Mike Marshman with the City of Portland Police Bureau. It's my pleasure to speak with you all here today to give you an update on the City of Portland and the United States Department of Justice settlement agreement. So when I began police work about a quarter of a century ago, there was a feeling of good guys and bad guys. I mean, life was fairly simple for us back then. Bad guys committed crimes. It was the job of the police to take those folks off the street and help protect the community. But as you know, times have changed quite drastically. With the decentralization of the mental health system, officers are now coming into contact with individuals who are impacted by mental health crisis. Even though some of those individuals have committed a low-level crime, we the police feel that the best place for these individuals is actually not in local jail. That's not the best place for what these individuals need. So the Portland Police Bureau's desire to serve those we contact, you know, we want to do that with dignity and respect. You know, it's just a morally and ethically correct thing to do with folks we come in contact with. For many years, it's been the Portland Police Bureau's policy to train all of our officers in what we call CIT training, crisis intervention training. We've been doing that for at least 15 years. We've advanced to that where recently we have an enhanced crisis intervention training model, which is about 80 or 90 officers who volunteered. It's built on the Memphis model system. But those officers have an increased capacity to engage with folks on the street who are either mentally ill or what we believe to be perceived with a mental health crisis. Now we have a third layer. We formed a behavioral health unit, and the interesting thing about that unit is police officers 40 hours a week in a patrol car are partnered with Project Respond, or you know, licensed clinical professionals, and they drive around and contact folks that we've come in contact with, follow up, research, and see other ways to help these individuals. And our fourth layer, it's one of the teams I help manage. It's our crisis negotiators. It's like when our SWAT team, you see those folks on TV, when they go out, we have a whole team of crisis negotiators that go out as well to help contact folks in crisis to help resolve the situation peacefully. So we've done quite a bit to advance our commitment to those in mental health crisis, and I believe the Portland Police Force is actually on the cutting edge of learning new systems and adopting best practices. And that's translated into, overall, in the last 5 years, our use of force is quite low, and it's descended over the last 5 years. And another good thing is our actual complaints, citizen complaints, has also declined over the last 5 years. So things in Portland are actually quite good. So with that background, in steps the United States Department of Justice investigation. In my opinion, the chief's opinion, the city and the mayor, it's actually a very, very good thing for the police bureau. The Department of Justice is enhancing our areas where we were, frankly, a little bit behind the curve on systems of accountability and quantitative and qualitative analysis. That is going to advance the Portland Police Bureau monumental leaps forward to be an overall just more productive, accountable agency internally and externally. So that's all those are good, good things. But in one area that I believe this committee can help us is it's small, but I think it's pivotal in this step, and that's in the area of a secure drop-off facility. I don't work the street anymore, but when I used to, I've taken many, many individuals to various secure drop-off centers. They've moved around in the city of Portland. They've had different names. It was just the right thing to do. And I have somebody who's committing a low-level crime for whatever reason. Our young officers throughout the ranks realize, the best place is not the jail. They need to go to a place that has the right treatment facility. In my opinion, taking somebody to an ER where it's more trauma, medical-based treatment, not as appropriate as to take somebody who has psychiatrists and psychologists who can help them begin that process to get better treatment. Those have closed in Portland, so we don't have those types of facilities anymore. And to me, I believe that's a real detriment for the police, who usually come in contact with individuals who are experiencing really acute system or violence. That's what we tend to get called. We need an appropriate place to take these individuals. I think that cog in this large system would help the Portland Police Bureau and other law enforcement agencies in the state. It essentially comes down to patient care. What's best for the patient? It's not jail. So that's just a brief summary. I don't want to take too much of your time. So just thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Our next speaker is going to be Deputy City Attorney Ellen Osinak. And at the end, I'll be happy to answer any questions if you have those. Thank you very much.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Ellen Osinak, and I'm one of the lead attorneys on the city's police practices case involving the Department of Justice. The United States Department of Justice and the city have for decades had successful partnerships to address the complexities of modern policing, and this case is no exception. Given our positive working relationship with the Department of Justice, we naturally turn to them as a valued partner as we struggle to supplement our existing efforts to improve the city's contacts with persons experiencing a mental health crisis. One of the reasons it made sense to us to utilize the DOJ's expertise was because this is a national problem, indeed an international problem. Mayor Hales, Commissioner Amanda Fritz, Commissioner Steve Novick, Commissioner Dan Saltzman, and Commissioner Nick Fish believe that Portland can and should be a national model. Every law enforcement agency in the country struggles with managing police responses to people who are experiencing mental health crises. And as I said, the Portland Police Bureau is no exception. But our longstanding engagement and our pioneering efforts with the United States Department of Justice are exceptional. Since 2008, every Portland police officer, as Captain Marshman said, in the Portland Police Bureau has received training in crisis intervention techniques. By 2010, the city was actively engaged with mental health stakeholders in the community, and those efforts caught the attention of the Bazelon Center for Mental Health Law. In 2011, they selected Portland as one of five cities in which to conduct a national pilot for exploring comprehensive strategies aimed at reducing crisis contacts with the police. But the city knew that we needed more. And in 2011, the city asked the United States Department of Justice to conduct a top-to-bottom review of the city's policing practices with regard to use of force. In response, the U.S. DOJ conducted an 18-month investigation with which the city fully and openly cooperated, providing DOJ with prompt and complete access to documents and personnel. In 2012, the DOJ sent the city a letter notifying us of their finding that the city had deficiencies in specific policies, training, and supervision, and they offered us comprehensive solutions to those deficiencies. But they took great pains to acknowledge that the relationship between what they explained were key deficiencies in the state's mental health infrastructure and how that impacted Portland's increased contacts with and police encounters with people in crisis. In fact, there is an entire section of our findings letter entitled Serious Deficiencies in the Mental Health System, in which the DOJ gave the city some insight into its ongoing investigation with the state. The DOJ specifically noted that while some crisis services exist in Portland, there is an inadequate capacity of mobile crisis teams, crisis apartments, and importantly for our discussion today, a lack of crisis walk-in drop-off centers. In response to the DOJ's findings, the city immediately and publicly committed itself to work towards a settlement with the DOJ rather than engage in protracted litigation. Over a period of 2 months, the two sides engaged in intense negotiations, which produced a 72-page settlement agreement. And I'm pleased to report that that settlement agreement was just entered by the court several weeks ago, although the city has been implementing for about 2 years the various provisions. The city agreed to make reforms in all areas over which we experienced control, such as our use of force policy, our dispatch protocols, data collection, and the creation of specialized mental health units. But as the DOJ noted, the city is unlikely to achieve its goal of reducing police contacts and improving services for people in crisis without the state's active involvement in filling the gaps in Portland's mental health infrastructure. And that is why we're here today. At the time that the DOJ issued its findings letter, the state was in the early stages of your healthcare transformation process. And neither the DOJ nor the state could accurately predict when the gaps in Portland's infrastructure might be filled. And in addition, the state did not, and you currently do not, have a written agreement with the Department of Justice. So the only place for the parties to memorialize the city's understanding of when those gaps might be filled was in our own agreement. And so included in our settlement agreement is the following language. The United States expects that local CCOs will establish by mid-2013 one or more drop-off centers for first responders. This language has created considerable confusion, with some believing that the United States and the city in our agreement agreed that the city would build, fund, or operate a drop-off center. But that is not the case. And of course, mid-2013 has come and gone, and there is still not a drop-off center in Portland. Consumers and advocates are understandably frustrated, as is frankly the city.
As is frankly this committee.
But the state, yes, and we do want to acknowledge that the state has given a significant amount of additional mental health investment dollars, and the city for the last 2 years has prioritized mental health funding in its legislative agenda. And those funds have been used to fill some important gaps, such as expanding the operational hours of the city's walk-in center, the enhancement of the project response team, and the additional of a forensic act team. And even though these improvements do not address the core need of the city for a drop-off center, we want to acknowledge that they are important. And as Mary Claire Buckley will discuss next, there is much reason to hope that a critical mass of stakeholders may be ready to tackle a drop-off center. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have about the city's settlement agreement. Thank you.
We're going to hold questions until all the testimony is in.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Mary Claire Buckley, and I work for the Portland Police Bureau with the DOJ compliance team. And as was mentioned, because this commentary was contained in the Portland Police Bureau's agreement, a number of advocates and consumers had the expectation that the Portland Police would be resolving this issue regarding the drop-in center. Mayor Hales was, you know, very committed to resolving this, but clearly the City of Portland and the Police Bureau do not have, you know, the forte to build and establish and run a mental health facility. So once the consumers and advocates started to express concern that no action had been taken on this, the mayor met with us and asked Captain Marshman and myself to, or charged us with the responsibility of reinitiating conversations with the stakeholders who might be able to achieve this end. So Captain Marshman and I identified the initially the institutional stakeholders who would play a role in this endeavor, which included representatives from the state mental health division, the county mental health, the two CCOs that are functioning in Multnomah County, and met with them to discuss, you know, our concerns about the lack of or this gap in the crisis services in Portland. We then convened, brought them all to the table, had our initial meeting in May, and then in subsequent meetings, the critical partner of the hospital system joined us because, as you can imagine, this is a area of tremendous concern to hospital emergency rooms who are currently being overrun with individuals who have behavioral health crises, you know, filling their emergency rooms, remaining for days at a time waiting for other beds or to be moved to other facilities. So this was clearly on their radar. And in fact, once we brought them to the table, it was clear that they have already started to initiate on their own some exploration of what options might be available in lieu of using these emergency rooms. You know, just to give you an example, the legacy hospital system last year had more than 10,000 emergency room admissions for people in psychiatric crisis. 10,000, and that's just the legacy system. So we met with Legacy, Providence, Portland Adventist, and Oregon Health Sciences University, brought them to the table, and in fact, they shared with us that they had, as I said, been exploring this, had toured other examples around the country, and have now settled on, I believe, the Alameda County model in California, which is a psychiatric emergency center, where rather than going to regular emergency rooms, the goal would be to have those sent to this one specialized unit. It has been hailed by many as a way of reducing the boarding, as you may have heard a number of articles recently, even in the Willamette Week, talked about the boarding of mental health patients. It would reduce the boarding times and enhance the patient care. The reason for this would be that it would be focused solely on psychiatric. It would have psychiatrists rather than emergency room doctors or trauma doctors treating them. It also you know, gives them an opportunity to assess them, give them intensive treatment right there, rather than, you know, just triaging and transferring them out. They could get that care often in less than 23 hours to stabilize them and to then hook them up with the necessary community services as a follow-up rather than just opening the door of the emergency room and letting them leave, which then, you know, creates that revolving door that we often see. So, you know, since those, you know, initial meetings in May, I have to say that, you know, we are much more hopeful that this, you know, issue and problem, longstanding since, you know, the triage center in Portland closed a number of years ago, might be resolved. However, it's going to take the collaboration of the partners who have been at the table, and that includes the state, the county, and the CCOs in committing the necessary fiscal piece to this. Obviously, these hospitals can't go down this road without some, at least understanding that there will be some stability to the funding stream, and also there are other areas in terms of licensing that they may well need the state's assistance in. And they will also actually look to the Portland Police to maybe change our practices to meet their model. But we believe that this would be not only good for the hospitals, the law enforcement, but most importantly to those who suffer these psychiatric or behavioral health crises, because they will get the care and treatment they need in a better place. Obviously, emergency rooms are not designed for that. They are the most expensive, most restrictive, if you want to look at it that way, and also sometimes the least effective in dealing with these kind of situations. So we are continuing to meet. We have met monthly since May, and we have our next meeting this week, but we want to continue that partnership, and I expect that the hospital group, they are actually the four hospitals are joining together, you know, in a coalition to try and develop. They have identified a site that this facility may be placed and willing to make that capital investment if they can be assured that this is a sustainable option. So we are, as I said, hopeful. And just we'll continue to work on this effort until this gap in the crisis system in Portland has been resolved. And I thank you for your concern and attention to this matter. And we'll take any questions you have.
Thank you, Mayor Claire.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I'm going to be brief. I think we've used a lot of our time, and I think it's better used taking questions from you folks so that we can answer your concerns. But what I do want to acknowledge is something that the city attorney, assistant city attorney for Portland, said, which is from the chair I sit in as your U.S. attorney, and walking into the U.S. attorney's office in 2011, while this investigation was already in full swing with the city and getting fully up to speed, and then working on this case, not only as the U.S. attorney, because I know it's such an important case to the state of Oregon and to the city of Portland, and because of my background representing DHS and having some background in mental health, I worked also as a lawyer on this case, so I was reviewing everything and working as part of the negotiation team and the team that drafted the final settlement agreement from 2011 up until I sit before you today. And what I really want to acknowledge is that the City of Portland has been the most amazing, open, transparent partner in addressing these issues in the city. The Portland Police Bureau, as the city attorney mentioned, has been implementing the pieces of the agreement that they had the authority to implement 2 years ago, long before the court entered the settlement agreement. The things that you heard from Portland Police today about the behavioral health unit, changes to training, changes to use of force protocol, the community outreach they've done, the engagement of stakeholders that they've done, has just, it doesn't surprise me, because from the minute that we handed them the findings letter in 2012, in early 2012, I mean, that was a difficult letter. You've all seen it, and it makes some pretty stark findings, and that's going to sting anybody who gets that letter. But within 24 hours, they were all sitting in my office, the chief of police, Mayor Adams, members of the city attorney's office, with their hands open saying, what do we do to work together to address this for the citizens of Portland? And that collaborative nature, the transparent nature of that relationship has really, I think, led to all of the success. And what you've heard here today, I am just completely behind and excited about, because you know, Chief Reese has been a change agent, and he's now being asked to speak all over the country to other police chiefs about these exact reforms. He's become a leader for the country, and that's why really the whole nation owes a debt of gratitude to the city of Portland, because we are creating models now that will be followed by other cities in the United States, because it's true this isn't a problem that just exists in Portland. But Portland was a great place to make this stand, because we have such great partners there and that have really taken a leadership position to not sort of, you know, fight tooth and nail, but really to see the opportunity to address these issues systemically. So I do want to commend the city. There are still other parts of the agreement that will now move forward with implementation because the settlement is in place, which is the creation of the Community Oversight Advisory Board, the COAB, and the hiring, which they're already engaged in, of the COCOL, who is the compliance officer that will oversee the implementation of the agreement. agreement, and those pieces will be very important. But I think this committee is more interested in how the city has worked with stakeholders to address the gaps in mental health that lead people in crisis into jails and hospitals instead of community-based treatment center. And I know you're going to have another panel to discuss to look at what the state's doing to implement those changes.
It's very gratifying to hear you say that. That's very encouraging. I think we've been very concerned as a committee about what has been happening the last couple of years. And I hope that in December, early December, we'll have committee days again, and I'm hoping we can bring in the CCOs as well as the county mental health programs, because we keep hearing about the need for these programs that the city has not the money nor the ability to set these up. That is not the city's responsibility. So we do need to set up these mental health crisis centers, especially in the city of Portland, in order to make all of this work together as a whole. So we will do that in early December. Can you help us do that, Cheyenne? Great. Any questions of this panel? Yes, Representative.
Thank you. Lynch. Thank you so much for coming and for the work that you're doing to try to address this important need. I have an observation and a question. As a former Clackamas County Commissioner, at the time when the CCOs were being created, I know we, too, felt really concerned about meeting mental health needs. And I just want to call out, Clackamas County doesn't always get lauded for some of the innovative work they do, but Clackamas County has created a crisis drop-in center and has done a lot of work to make sure that mental health professionals are in with the sheriff's office team to do emergency response. And so I want to note that I think it's exciting that that community has taken some good steps on that front. And I want to ask, is the crisis center that you're looking to develop similar to the Centerstone facility, or is it more of essentially a specialized emergency facility for psychiatric patients?
Madam Chair, Representative Lindinger, it's going to be a psychiatric emergency room, basically. Mm-hmm. My understanding of the Cornerstone is it's not a 24/7 facility, and so this would be open 24/7, and the expectation would be that when police or others have in need to have someone in crisis brought, that they would have a medical clearance, and then once that's done, they would go to this facility. They can do the, you know, basically the assessment, do the immediate acute care, and then would determine whether they needed, where they needed to go next. Mm-hmm. So it's a little, okay. It's more intense.
Follow up.
Then I have a question as to the CCO funding structure. And you're not CCO people, but my understanding was that the idea behind CCOs is that everyone would get together to invest in the crucial gap services using the existing money so as to, you know, use our existing money for the highest and best uses and decrease the overall costs. Is it your sense that CCO's current money is going to fund this psychiatric facility, or is it... Because I thought that was the concept, we would use existing money to fund some of those expensive things.
Madam Chair, Representative Lineger, I would think that is a very good question for the panel you're going to have from OHA that's going to talk about addressing the issues with community-based care and CCOs. I mean, it really is. That's been part of the confusing thing about this settlement agreement is that the city of Portland isn't responsible for implementing those issues. And I understand, and I've met with the CCOs, that there is some level of confusion about who is responsible. And that led to the U.S. Attorney's and the Department of Justice's investigation into the state mental health system, which led to the settlement of the investigation, which I have declined to speak to you about. So I think that those are better questions for OHA and that panel.
Madam Chair, Representative Lingenger, I think that the hospitals are anxious to hear that answer as well, because the funding stream has to be, firmly in place in order for them to undertake this huge investment that they're now exploring.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your panel. This is an issue that comes up over and over and over again, and thank you for focusing on it. And we cannot move forward as a state unless we figure this out. So you've pointed to a really important need. I'd love at some other point to hear the backstory on why the crisis center closed in the past, how that had been funded. But I think one of the challenges is not the need for it and that we should do it, but who has responsibility for what in funding it? That's the sticky part. And, you know, my hope would be mental health does not hit just the CCO population, the people on Oregon Health Plan. It hits everyone. But the partners that make up the CCO, the hospitals and others, we are hoping, being more innovative in trying to reduce hospitalization and reuse the money in other ways. And so I would think that and insurance, along with OHP and what they're going to reimburse for, are really important people to engage in the conversation, because in terms of having a sustainable operation on an ongoing basis, they have to be a part of paying for a new way of delivering care that's more cost effective and that is a part of a kind of continuing of care, step up, step down. So the degree to which the state should pay versus hospitals, insurers, you know, and others is, I think, the key to figuring this out. And I'm looking to my other chair as well, who's been very engaged in healthcare reform.
And we're going to ask the question of our next panel. Representative Greenlick, you look interested. Do you have anything to say or ask?
Well, the problem came about with the notion that CCO mental health money for the care of the Medicaid population needs to be mixed with the medical care money. But what happened prior to the CCOs is state mental health money went to the counties. They braided it with some of their own funds to take care of the perspective of the whole mental health. We now sort of took that leg out of it by taking a piece of that money and giving it to CCOs and giving the remainder to the counties, but they end up not having enough money to try and deal with the infrastructure of the whole system. So we obviously need to find some way to supplement that to get infrastructure issues particularly taken care of. And it's obviously very much on the agenda now.
Absolutely. And it's interesting how we can find $1,000 a day to put somebody in the state hospital when they could be served much more efficiently and effectively in their own community. We're going to have to move on unless there's some other quick question that we need to have answered. Thank you so much.
You're
and
welcome.
Thank you to the City of Portland and to the USDOJ for doing such a great job on this. Thank you. Next, we're going to be having Pam Martin, Director of the Addictions and Mental Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority. Pam, are you bringing anybody up with you?
Nope.
All right. A panel of one.
I think I have a PowerPoint.
You do have a PowerPoint?
That's okay. I can get started.
Pam, we have no more than 15 minutes here. I want to apologize for everybody. We had to push so much into this committee meeting of 3 hours, so we're having to rush people along. I apologize for that, but there's so much that we need to deal with.
Madam Chair, I will stay within that time period.
Thank you.
So for the record, my name is Pam Martin, and I'm the Director of Addictions Mental Health, and I'm here to give you an update on our agreement with the United States Department of Justice. I don't think I have to belabor the Olmstead decision.
Right.
I think everybody is familiar with the fact that it's based on institutional segregation, the fact that under the Americans with Disability Act, this is there is an integration mandate so that people can live in the most integrated community setting. And we all now start from with the assumption that people can live in their own homes unless that's proven otherwise. That's it. So we have a letter of agreement, which has been termed a unique opportunity for our state and the United States Department of Justice to collaborate. And we have a 4-year agreement. In the first year, we collected data from the system. So year two, we identified gaps, and quite frankly, we spent a lot of time talking about that matrix of data to collect, and defining the data, and making sure we could collect it accurately. And now we are starting, as of November, on year three, we're going to be collecting good, clean data and identifying outcome measures and then going into the year four. Since we last talked to this committee, We have held quarterly meetings with USDOJ, which happened in July. And one thing that felt like an important underpinning was to develop a comprehensive strategic plan so that addictions and mental health could go forward for a couple of years during this time of intense transformation. Having made decisions along with our partners and communities about what we should focus on. So over the spring and summer, we held 6 town hall meetings, did a webinar, had a tribal consultation, and we're now, we have a draft strategic plan, and we're meeting with some community leaders in the area of health and mental health, and we hope to finalize that. But we did have a chance to take this to USDOJ, and they were quite positive about the direction, had some very good suggestions, which we followed up on. So that's been part of the activity. We've trained over 500 providers on our new data collection system, and I'm very proud of the fact that we opened up an Office of Consumer Activities within Addictions and Mental Health. So now we are not one of the last states not to have that. So at our meeting, we discussed the strategic plan draft, which we had available for them. We finalized the data matrix and the data dictionary, and these are now both posted on our website. We gave them an update on the measures and outcome tracking system known as MOTS. We had a follow-up discussion about assertive community treatment. As you may know, the assertive community treatment is designed to address problems that people have when they have severe and persistent illness and they need a complex care team around them for some period of time. These complex care teams spend most of their time out of the office with their patients and their clients in the field, and they have no more than 100 people. They're made up of a psychiatrist, a social worker, a nurse, I mean a peer counselor. So the presence was, we were able with new funding to expand the number of assertive community teams in the state and start the first forensic community assertiveness team. And I believe Oregon is the first of any state to have an assertive community treatment team devoted to Native Americans. So we're really happy about that. We discussed supported employment. As you probably know, most people with mental illness want to work. It's validating. It's like the rest of us. It's a reason to get up in the morning, and helps people in so many ways. And we talked to them about our new Office of Consumer Activities. We have a number of work plans. I think there are 7. Several of them are identified here. Work plans that are specifically give updates to United States Department of Justice. One is an agreement with law enforcement, which is our MOUs that we're helping to facilitate. Another was a way to tap into the feelings physicians are having about any barriers they have to treating people with mental health issues. So we're including that in a large physician survey that's going out, and we talked to them about what we think is a problem with our crisis lines in Oregon, the problem being that there are too many of them, and it's hard for people to know where to call. There are probably over 30 of them.
So what's being done about that?
We've had a work team going for about 6 months, and we have we've done surveys of the crisis lines. We've done, and we're trying to reach consensus about what would be a good next step.
Help us understand why there wouldn't be one crisis line for the whole state.
I'm Representative Tomei and members of the committee. I'm not sure how this grew, but I think it's like a lot of things that people. We have some main crisis lines that are tied into national lines, and then other organizations independently developed crisis lines, and they just stayed. And what I'm defining as a crisis line is that not an organization that only has a 24-hour crisis line for their own clients, but where a line is open for anyone who wishes to call. And we have many, many that are active in the state of Oregon, and we have a lot of good people discussing how we might compress that and make it easier for consumers or anybody.
When do you think you might reach a consensus on that?
We have set a goal of the end of December. We have meetings every month with a group that we're working with.
I would hope again that there will be a report here. Probably you wouldn't have it in early December, but maybe when the committee meets in January, that would be good to hear from. That was an issue that Representative Gelser dealt with in her community, and I'm hoping that you're involved with this. Thank you. I'm sorry, Pam, go ahead.
No, thank you. Yes. The delegation from USDOJ also toured the Oregon State Hospital for the first time.
Really?
Yes. So I think you have in a packet, you do have a letter dated August 8th from Judy Preston, who is the principal deputy chief of the special litigation section. She's our lead attorney with USDOJ in Oregon. So in her letter, she said that Oregon remains on target. The letter states that the USDOJ is encouraged by the steps we're taking to expand community-based services. They comment on the collaborative process, and we absolutely feel it's been a collaborative process. We agreed upon the date that the data matrix and data dictionary would be publicly available, and we have done that. And she talks about the strategic plan a little bit, and a comment about bringing housing forward more, which we have done. So that's concerning the letter. And then the next steps are we are finalizing the Behavioral Health Strategic Plan. We're meeting with USDOJ in November, at which time we're going to talk more about the assertive community treatment teams. We're going to give them more information about our supported employment program, which we were able to expand both of those areas with investments from the last legislative session. They are getting a orientation to the transformation of healthcare in Oregon, understanding more about the role of the coordinated care organizations, and they want to hear more about the 17 incentive measures that focus on outcomes, five of which are directly related to behavioral health. They're going to meet the people we've hired to run our Office of Consumer Activities, and we will be starting to establish our year 3 outcome measures.
Thank you, Pam. As you know, in attending our committee meetings over this past year or so, that we're really interested in what's happening on the ground. So, I mean, it sounds like there are lots of meetings and lots of plans, et cetera, et cetera. One of the things we've just heard about and that we've been very interested in this committee is the crisis programs that would be available certainly in Portland but throughout the state. And so one of the issues we just heard about was how do you fund that? How is that funded? So we're talking about state funds. We're talking about state funds that go to community or county mental health programs, et cetera. So can you just give us a brief overview about how that is going to be coordinated and how, rather than just these meetings and people talking about these issues, when are we going to see something on the ground? And I'm holding that question for a minute because I know that Representative Greenlick has his hand up and wants.
I just wanted to ask another question. We're hearing more and more about evidence-based preventive services that are available. Is there some, at least, mention of prevention as a part of this DOJ work?
So answer my question first and then get back to you.
Yeah, just put it on the board.
Yes.
Okay. I'll come back to that. Okay, so the first question you have is about the Portland USDOJ agreement and services needed in the metropolitan area in general. We have been part of those meetings, and what has struck me as a very important thing that's been accomplished so far is that we had Multnomah County come in and give and show the full array, the full mapping of crisis services. services in that area. Because what I'm interested, of course, is making sure that there is a good continuum of care and that we build on services that are there. So we had done that, and there are a lot of crisis services, and they're not all connected as well as they might be, but the gaps still remain. And so to help us sort through that, we have actually are bringing in a national consultant. Her name is Kathy Madenwald. She's coming in on October 20th, because what we want is some advice about how you set up a comprehensive system. So we have the information that we think we need in terms of mapping. We want some consultation, and then I think we'll be in, we at Oregon Health Authority will be in a better position to say what would be the different ways that we could fill that gap, whether it be through additional mobile crisis or whatever that might be, or an emergency center or something. At the same time, there is the Emmanuel Providence Legacy folks are looking at the facility that's now filled with the Oregon State Hospital Portland campus, and they're looking at possible ways of using that space to follow something called the Alameda model, where you have a consolidated 24-hour psychiatric emergency department. So we're working with public health and putting together thoughts about that planning. So I think there are a number of things in the work. You know, asking when there would be something concrete on the ground is a difficult question for me.
Thank you. And I know that Representative Greenlick is waiting for his question. I appreciate the meetings. I heard Representative Tomei's question a little differently. I think it's less about what is the planning and what are the meetings that are happening, but statewide, what is the funding and the support that's available? I don't live in Portland. My constituents don't live in Portland. I had a suicidal person that had no place to go the day she needed help. So what is happening today on the ground for our constituents who are in crisis? And I appreciate that in the meeting there's a continuum of services, but we just heard from the Portland Police Bureau that the most important thing that they need just isn't there, and we don't know who's responsible. Can you tell us who's responsible mm-hmm. for funding that and how we will get it in Portland and where Representative Whitsitt and I live as well?
Madam Chair and Representative Gessler and members of the committee, I believe it will end up being braided funding. It will be local communities. It will be money that is sent through to the community mental health centers. It will be state funding. I think they'll be braided. That has been our experience with programs that we're putting together now. We actually put in place a number of mobile crisis and other crisis units around the state. I testified yesterday about the new investments, and I'm going to be over time giving much more information about that. So in some of those cases, what the state funding did was to provide kind of a boost to get teams organized or to do initial hiring. And then in many cases, there can be billing through Medicaid that happens after that. So each of the, depending on the type of program that's put together and looking at the sustainability, it's going to range. There's going to be a wide range depending on who our partners are. I'm sorry that I can't be more explicit, but a lot of times these are public-private partnerships or public-public partnerships with local communities, jails, mental health court. I mean, this is complicated, braided funding. Our strategic plan, though, does have a very explicit section about the need to have a core basic services in every community. I mean, we really heard that in our town hall visits in rural and frontier areas of Oregon.
And I appreciate that it's in the plan. I just look forward to seeing it move from an aspiration that's written on paper to something that actually happens with a concrete plan of who's responsible by what date for carrying something out. And it sounds like we have an understanding from the U.S. Department of Justice about when those things are supposed to be there, and I don't think we're quite meeting the timelines at this point.
Thank you, Representative Gelser. Good points. Representative Greenlick, you had a question that you'd like to have answered.
Yeah, when I was looking at the full scope of your agreement, I didn't say anything about prevention. And we now know there are many evidence-based prevention programs for schools and other things, and it seems to me we're never going to deal with the problem. We're never going to provide enough services. We're never going to be able to deal with it unless we stop the flood of people coming to us. So I was just wondering whether there's anything in the agreement about mental health problem prevention.
Madam Chair and Representative Greenlick, there is nothing in our agreement explicitly, but there certainly is in our strategic plan. We are putting funding into a program called Mental Health First Aid, which is a wonderful prevention program for people. It's kind of like CPR for mental health. We put as much funding into prevention as we can. I would say that our ESA program, youth hubs, and some other programs are very much in that line. The fact that it's not explicit in the agreement with USDOJ is not a reflection on that agreement. It just means it doesn't cover everything that we are doing at all.
We're going to have more. I'm sorry, we need to move on. And I know Representative Wisnett has a comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment, Director Martin. Your plan didn't mention we're going to have testimony today about youth suicide. And I think your strategy plan should at least highlight the need to help teens and also military veterans with PTSD. Madam Chair, I share your frustration. 11 years in the building. We need a plan in action and quit studying and having meetings. Thank you.
I agree. Thank you. Thank you very much, Pam. Okay, we're moving on to Secure Adolescent Inpatient Program. Kim Scott from Trillium Family Services and Megan Storrs. And I'm sorry, we've got 10 minutes and that's it. We're slow today.
That's all I need.
Getting behind. Great.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and Committee. I'm Kim Scott, and I'm the Chief Executive Officer for Trillium Family Services. Trillium provides services to youth in our programs from Portland, Salem, Corvallis. We have a strong prevention component in our programs. We're in over 70 schools across Oregon, partnering with higher education, hospitals, and schools to provide community-based services. However, we also provide facility-based care. One of the programs that I want to talk to you about today is our Secure Adolescent Inpatient Program in Corvallis. For those of you who don't know it, back in 2001, we partnered with the state. It was one of the proudest moments of my career in deinstitutionalizing children who had been at the Oregon State Hospital. We now provide that level of care for Oregon, starting in 2001 with the Secure Children's Inpatient Program in Portland, and then in 2004 with this adolescent inpatient program. Over that time, in terms of efficiency, we have financial information that shows that we've saved the state approximately, it's approaching $150 million in terms of direct program costs. It would have cost you to provide that service over that same time frame. So that program has been very effective as far as efficiencies and also in terms of outcomes. I'm here today with a specific ask. I think that the state really met its statutory requirements in terms of providing a hospital level of care for the adults and created a facility that is, in terms of it has the therapeutic dignity required in healing. It's also a program that is safe in terms of the patients, in terms of the community, the staff that work there. And that's not the case with the Secure Adolescent Inpatient Program in Corvallis. These are facilities that were never designed for this population, and over the time they have significantly eroded. At the end of this month, we're starting the building of our phase one. But ultimately, that project, the first phase, is a $5.5 million project. We've received a grant of $2 million from the state towards that. But what we're asking for the first phase is another $750,000 so that we can get the state to participate at 50% level. The next phase is $23 million, and we'll be asking the state to participate to, again, in half of that. That's $11.5 million. These are critical services for all children in Oregon. And again, for us, it's about creating that same level of therapeutic dignity and safety and community safety that we need. I want you to know we do have replicated what the state hospital would have done. I mean, we provide community mental health services for those children and youth that have the most urgent needs in the state, the most vulnerable population. But we also, what I would like to say about that is that that program, in connection with other programs, give us a continuity of care where we're able to move children and families through a variety of services that end up, in my mind, being really healing and life-saving. So that's enough from me. I would like to turn it over to my colleague and member of our foundation board and former client at the Secure Adolescent Inpatient Program in Portland. This is Megan Storrs.
Good morning. My name is Megan Storrs. I just recently had my 21st birthday, and now more than ever do I celebrate my life. But I wouldn't have been here to experience them, these years of my life, the best years of my life, without the treatment I received from Trillium. I was born into a very abusive family. Multiple members of my family were arrested with counts of sex abuse, assault, and neglect towards me. And in turn, I was placed into foster care, where I bounced around in a total of 11 homes. Some of these families continued to abuse me. I was 14 at this time, and I had 14 years of trauma. It was brutal, miserable. I felt that I had no point, no future, no hope, no love or purpose. So I began starving and cutting myself. I tried to take my own life on multiple occasions. The fact that I'm here today is truly a miracle. Back then, all I could think about was the pain. To make matters worse in my head, the same lack of stability I experienced in home placement, I also experienced in hospitals and treatment centers. I began the first of many intense interventions at Sacred Heart Riverbend, where I spent 6 weeks with a feeding tube. Shortly after, I was transferred to day treatment in Portland. Then I was readmitted into the hospital at Dornbecker. Then I went back to day treatment, then to St. Vincent Medical, and then to Providence Psych. Finally, I ended up at the Children's Farm Home, where I spent a year and a half and was diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, and anorexia. This is a similar story to many children, just like me, who after many tries found stabilization at the Children's Farm Home. What was different? How was it better? I'll tell you. A dedicated and carefully selected staff crew, an intense but encouraging treatment program, and an exemplified approach that every life is worth living. These staff really cared. They were available, they tried, and they listened. Life became safe, understanding, and consistent. And because of this, I learned to slow down, to breathe, and to relax. I learned how to be patient with myself. I learned how to nurture important relationships. I learned that my diagnoses weren't shameful. They were viewed as a typical illness. Here are the symptoms. This is the plan. It was viewed as a positive outlook, a way to move forward into a new life. It wasn't an all-defining title. I learned to love myself, and I learned to live. If I was asked to name a complaint, it would be nothing of the quality of care given, the treatment, staff, program, or management. That in and of itself was stellar. My concern is the building, the facility. I have memories of fellow clients kicking out windows that were made of glass, thinking in my head, why are these glass? We know the type of people who are in here. I remember the daunting fence that made it feel like we were prisoners getting punished. I remember the dim lights. And I remember when multiple people would begin to melt down at the same time, and there were only two designated quiet areas that were easily accessible. Felt like you had to wait in line for your turn. And I was forced to cry in front of my peers and felt vulnerable. This is the building I lived in 5 years ago. I can't imagine that it's improved, and the condition at that time was unacceptable. Skilled architects have addressed each of my concerns and have dedicated their work to creating a healing and safe environment. And we're doing our part to raise funds. I'm asking that you do yours. Know that this isn't just any business we're talking about. This is a group of people who have based their business on the quality of life. Let me remind you of where I came from, a terribly hopeless and dark beginning. Now, let me expand on where I am now. I'm a healthy member of society. I am working full-time as a department manager in my company. I am volunteering with Trillium Family Services on the board and speaking engagements. I am now a medication-free sister, friend, aunt, girlfriend, advocate, taxpayer, employee, and mom to a beautiful puppy. Let me tell you that I'm not alone in my passion for life. I'm here today representing the thousands of children who suffer from trauma and mental illness. I am representing both the recipients of quality treatment and the unfortunate who have not yet found quality treatment, peace, health, and safety. They would tell you the same, though, if they were here. We need this care. We need this building. We need your support, and we can't do this alone. We are intelligent, successful, and contributing members of society. And we are young. Invest in us, because we can make a huge impact on this world. Thank you.
Thank you, Megan. It's nice to hear something positive today. That's wonderful. Not that everything else was negative, but congratulations. Good job. I'm
Thank
really
you.
Happy for you. Any quick questions?
Yes. I just want to thank you for coming today. It's great to have this program in our community, and I've appreciated your leadership on these issues for years.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Okay, next we have an update on sex trafficking, shelter, and governance. So I think we have five people coming up for this. Yeah.
I'd like to talk to them. I won't use it again.
You wonder what turned that around, don't you?
Thank you. Just like that. Okay, who's going to speak first today?
Not it.
Sorry? Who's going to speak first? You guys must have figured that out by now, right?
Not Matt.
Okay, who would like to speak first?
Introducing it.
Go ahead. We have, what did we say, 15 minutes for this.
Chairs and members of the committee, my name is Mike Morris. I'm an administrator with the Addictions and Mental Health Division, and I'll make my portion very brief. I just want to update this committee on there are two working agreements that we're working on with the Department of Justice on, and that is one is to the establishment of an advisory group that goes forward from the work that was initiated by Representative Tomei. And so it's a memorandum of understanding regarding the establishment and then the ongoing support to make sure that that work continues. And then there is an interagency agreement that we're working on to provide funding for a position within the Department of Justice that AMH would provide that funding so that that individual could then, one is go after grants and other funding to have that position permanent on an ongoing basis, and then also to establish a statewide strategy for the prevention, early intervention, and services for this vulnerable population. So we're at the point where we have the things drafted, and we're just finalizing, and I'm hopeful that within the next few weeks we'll have those agreements in place.
Great. So Shannon, are you're scheduled to speak too, right? You're going to be talking some about what we hope will be the board, right?
Hi, Shannon.
I guess I hadn't thought about how we should stage this, but I think after meeting for many, many months, was it years? We decided that we will have a program. And Stacey, thank you for coming, all of you, and you too. We want to hear about that program, but this is just one small piece of what is a big issue, and we're wanting to set up a board that would be following up what we couldn't do as our own little group that was meeting in my dining room there in Milwaukee for several months. So, Shannon, talk some about that and where that board is,
okay.
The potential of that board.
Chair, to my members of the committee, my name is Shannon Savelle from the Department of Justice. Actually, on the recommendation of Chair Tomei and U.S. Attorney Amanda Marshall, I believe the group that you convened began looking at the model of the CAMI Advisory Committee, and that is a multidisciplinary group that advises the Attorney General and myself on how our child abuse multidisciplinary funds should be used. Based on that model, We have drafted the MOU with the Addictions and Mental Health Division of the Oregon Health Authority, and this MOU will allow Crime Victim Services Division, which is the division I run in the DOJ, to convene an advisory committee that will provide recommendations and some oversight to AMH on funds that they receive to address the CSET population, on the shelter that they currently administer with those funds, and hopefully policies that they may pursue or jointly pursue with DOJ or other state partners moving forward to address the CSET population. I am waiting for the MOU to be finalized, and the only delay is due. We unfortunately lost Leah Kraft, who was wonderful and integral to this. And so that has just simply slowed the process slightly, but the documents are all drafted, and I believe they'll be signed probably within the next week or so. At that point, we will be beginning to kind of convene this advisory committee. I would like to take a little bit of time to do that, and by a little bit of time I mean perhaps a month, because it's really important to work with people that are already addressing the CSEC issue, which in Oregon is currently happening in the Tri-Counties area, and to talk with them about the partners that they've engaged, and to ensure that the people we put on this committee will be people that can work with those partners, that some of them will be those partners, because we need to build what will be a collaborative statewide effort. And I'm hoping that we will base that on what is currently happening up in Multnomah County, which is the county that's primarily addressing CSEC in a collaborative manner. So my hope is to take 4 or 5 weeks. I've been, you know, attending the meetings, meeting with the police department, meeting with the nonprofits, and trying to really kind of distill who is actually involved, and for lack of a better term, the boots on the ground, and so that we can have an advisory committee that will be both policy or a little bit more high-level policy-oriented, and then have people that are actually in the communities doing the work as well, because I don't think it'll... I think that you have seen, perhaps, Chair Tomei, that when you just have, you know, one level of interaction, it's difficult to dial into the real nitty-gritty for kind of developing these policies and plans. Additionally, this advisory committee will be working with the individual that we hope to hire, with using the last CSET funds with OHA, and that individual will be helping distill this plan and getting the state of Oregon ready to apply for federal grants that I hope will be available in the next year. This last year, there were at least 3, if not 5, major grants that would have addressed different pieces of human trafficking, but really child sex trafficking. And we just simply weren't ready as a state with a plan to bring to this very competitive process. And my hope is that if we can get this person, this coordinator in place, then by March, February, maybe even January of next year, we'll be ready to start being competitive player for those major grants and finding additional funding.
And you are working closely with Senator Ron Wyden's office, I know.
Yes.
Great. Okay. Thanks so much, Ann. Who would like to be next?
No.
Okay.
My name is Amy Baker. I'm the Child and Family Manager with Addictions and Mental Health Division. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. My piece is really brief because I think who you really want to hear from is the program itself. The last time we did the update, basically we were in the process of doing a request for proposal. All of that's been completed. We had 2 applicants, and there was a very large panel that reviewed the 2 proposals very thoroughly, and our awardee is Morrison Child and Family Center, who's here today. We are very, very close to having the if not finalized, the contracts almost out the door. Morrison is busily preparing their facility to be ready to start serving kids in the relative near future. The next step in the process is really to start working on solidifying the referral process so that we are easily able to get some of these youngsters in an easy, understandable manner for all the parties involved. So I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Morrison so they can talk a little bit about what their program is going to look like.
Great. Thank you.
I'll start. My name is Drew McWilliams. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for Morrison Child and Family Services, and appreciate this opportunity, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. Morrison, in general, has been around 67 years and serves approximately 6,000 kids a year with mental health or addiction services. And as a mental health and addictions provider myself, it's been near and dear to our heart to want to work with this particular group of youth in a formalized program that provides safety and a great deal of focus on helping them to not be in this abusive kind of scenario that they end up being exploited. So it's with a great deal of pleasure that I want to introduce my colleague at Morrison, Margaret Scott, who is putting together this program for us. So thank you.
Thank you, Drew. Go ahead.
Representative Tomei, member of the committee. My name is Margaret Scott, and I am a division director at Morrison Child and Family Services. Most of my job involves our outpatient programs, but this CSEC residential program is coming under my division, partly due to the fact that I've been involved in the Multnomah County Collaborative since 2010, when the group from New York came out and did an initial training for us when we sort of formed that collaborative. So this is certainly something that I've been working for a long, long time, and I'm very pleased to be part of having come together this part of the system here for these children in Oregon. I think that it's been needed for a long time. The goal of our program is to provide a safe and secure setting for these girls who've been sexually exploited in order to give them a chance to define their experience, to make sense of it, to gain resilience and skills, to build on their own strength so that they can go back to their families and their community. That's our goal. So our program plans to be very youth-directed as far as involving them in their own treatment and helping to get their families involved in treatment so that that's really the only way we can get them back to their communities and their schools, which is where we want them to be. One of the biggest questions that we get is around the security of our program. It is a locked program. I don't for 1 minute believe that locks and video cameras are going to keep these children in the program. These children tend to be at high risk of elopement, which is why I believe that the treatment interventions are what's going to keep them there, the engagement of them in their program, and that's what's going to keep them. So for that reason, we're working very hard to recruit nationally to get a qualified program director as well as program staff. Once we had everyone in place, we'll be doing an intensive 5 to 7 day training to get everybody up to speed. The program will be trauma-informed. We plan to use several evidence-based models. It'll be with Foundation of Sanctuary model, using collaborative problem solving, as well as some other things that we hope will work. All girls will get timely medical care, as well as mental health care, substance abuse treatment, and family therapy. All of that will be included in the program.
Will there be follow-up program for them?
Yes. So we will have a full-time case manager who will be able to do engagement in the community, follow-up, either to do that themselves as well as connect them to natural resources. It is my firm belief that paid professionals are not going to be what's going to keep kids out of this life and out of being exploited again, but it's going to be connecting them to really strong support systems in their communities. So the case manager will do that work with them, and that'll be a focus of the program from the day they admit to the day they leave till after.
Till after? What timeline are you thinking of for after?
I don't have a timeline set for that. I think it's going to be dependent upon each girl and the resources that girl has, both what she has herself and what is in her community. I think some kids will need a significantly longer time with that model of engagement and that model of follow-up, and I think some kids have already established mental health providers in the community that once we've been able to get them into this safe and secure setting, that we'll be able to transition them back to their provider. We plan to help them maintain whatever relationships they have with providers already that they may come in with. Our plan is to maintain those relationships. Relationships are very, very important.
And how many girls will you have?
We will have 12 girls.
And ages?
11 to 15.
With flexibility.
With some flexibility on the upper ends of the age range.
Oh, say more about that, Amy.
So we, in some of our conversations with some of the programs, I think what we really want to, we want to have as much flexibility here as we can and still maintain the viability of the program. Obviously, you don't want to put younger kids with older kids because it's just a setup. And so really, it's looking at the developmental appropriateness of the kids. And so if you have a 16-year-old who's going to be fine in that environment, then we're completely open to that. So it really depends on who the girls are, And one other piece I wanted to add, Representative Tomei, is that we also, in the with the wraparound system of care expansion, we also put into contract that these girls would be eligible for wraparound care coordination. And so we have potential to basically follow them for quite some time, because obviously if we're going to put this kind of investment into them, we want to ensure that they're going to be successful.
And that's been a big problem in some of these programs in other states, is once they leave the program, there isn't that kind of strong follow-up and wraparound services that they
correct
need.
Madam Chair, are there any programs for boys?
We didn't cover that in this work group, but we'll see how this, well, I won't be here. You can see how this goes and look at that, too. But I think the biggest issue is around girls this age. But good question.
But not the only issue.
That's right. Exactly right. We're running out of time. And
switch.
Okay. All right. Stacey, I definitely want to hear from Amanda. Amanda's been involved in this from the very beginning. Thank you so much for coming. We're very excited. And we will be following up on these issues. When do you expect to open?
Hoping for late October, early November.
Wonderful. Good, good, good. Come back in December. Okay. Amanda, you've been a part of this from the very beginning, and it was partly due to your push that we got this group together, because we realized that there weren't a lot of services for the girls. If they went into foster homes, and Stacy worked with us on this, very often they would go in the front door and leave out the back door and take some other kids with them. Amanda kept saying, we need to keep these kids. We need to have a treatment facility where they could stay. And also, somebody who can testify against the perpetrators, not just the pimps, but also the men who are buying underage sex from these girls. So, Amanda, talk some about that.
Well, Representative Tomei, you're right. I mean, I, as you know, represented DHS Child Welfare at Oregon DOJ, so when I came into the U.S. Attorney's Office, I was pretty focused on prioritizing child exploitation, and to that end, really increase the resources that we devote to all types of child exploitation. And I came to really appreciate the significant issue of sex trafficking in the Portland metro area specifically, and how it intersects with gang life, and that a lot of criminals and gang members had found that exploiting young women was more lucrative and, frankly, less risky than selling drugs and guns.
I think that is such an important statement, that we all realize how big this issue is and how why it continues to get even larger.
And I think that's a great segue, because in terms of looking at the scope of the issue, when I first went to DHS and started to talk to them about the need to address this population from a dependency and treatment point of view, as opposed to a delinquency model that criminalizes the behavior of the victims instead of holding perpetrators accountable, of course, the first question that my great ex client will ask is, well, how do we know the scope of the problem? What have we done to quantify the scope of the problem? What's the population that you'd be looking to serve? Where is the evidence? Where are the metrics? And so I commissioned a study in conjunction with Portland State University and Professor Christopher Carey to define that. And so by reviewing data that was provided in partnership with DHS Child Welfare in Multnomah County and with the Sexual Assault Resource Center, which operates in really the Tri-County area, we looked at and counted the minor victims of sex trafficking in the metro area over a course of about 4 years. And initially when we came in, we were thinking we would identify about 100 girls, and we identified 368 victims of sex trafficking. And I want to make it clear that we did not consider law enforcement data, because at that time we didn't think the law enforcement data was consistent and reliable enough in terms of the identification of victims. So we, by relying only on data from Child Welfare and SARC, we only counted the population of victims who had actually had contact with the social service agency. And in the long run, that turned out to be, although it was not intentional, it was brilliant, because then when I went back to DHS Child Welfare, we were able to say, this is not just the population of victims. We know we've severely undercounted, because many of these girls are never going to have contact with DHS or SARC. But this is the population that potentially you could serve, because these are the kids who have already had some contact and intervention by either the state agency or the private nonprofit that provides services to victims in the Portland area. So once we had the, and so I wanted Representative Greenlick to kind of also address your issue about boys. And we know that there are male victims. We know they're less likely to come to the service and be counted. But we also didn't find them in our data. Of the population that we counted, I believe two were boys, and maybe one was a transgender. But what we learned is that these are our kids. They were primarily U.S.-born, American citizen, minor children that primarily live in the Northwest and are here. They're either Oregon kids or they're being trafficked on I-5 between Northern California, Seattle, Tacoma, and Oregon, and Portland primarily. So that kind of answers the question about what we identified as the largest population that we could serve, but that's not to say that we don't have other populations that we need to address. But what I just want to say, I know I'm talking quickly, is one, Representative Tomei, you've been such a leader in this issue, and I feel like I was banging my head into a wall for a year before you came together and just, you know, by your sheer will, convened this group of people. And this was my vision 3 years ago, was that Oregon Department of Justice would be a home for an infrastructure that could bring some accountability into the funding streams, so that we didn't have all of these private nonprofits out doing fun runs and selling cookies and raising money to buy soap in hotel rooms, which isn't that that's not great, but it's just that what these kids really need is treatment and security and safety. And if we could pool that energy of the private sector and the public sector, but have some accountability and oversight within an existing board structure of multidisciplinary team members, then I had this vision that you shared with me, that we could have something in the long term that would solve these issues and be able to gather research and evidence-based practices. And again, you know, like the Portland Police Settlement, become really a model for what works for the nation. And I think we are so uniquely situated to do that with our leadership at the state level, with your leadership here, and with Senator Wyden in Washington, D.C. It's a great time to address this issue. And I just want to thank the Attorney General, Ellen Rosenblum, for giving us Shannon Saval, who, you know, not to overstate or be too arrogant, can become the new Amanda on this group. I really feel like you being here before you for the last time and having Shannon here for the first time is a great sort of transition into where this is going, and a real opportunity for leadership in the future. So thank you.
Thank you, Amanda. I just want to point out, we're looking at a program that is going to be dealing maybe with 15 girls. This is just the beginning, and it's a great beginning. I'm just delighted to have this happen. But we're looking at a big program, and we're hoping that we're going to be more involved with the nonprofits, who are also very invested in this issue and are willing to work with the state. There's no way the state can afford to provide all the services that these kids will be needing, but it's a start, and we're going to get involved with the nonprofits. So thank you so much. How's our timing? We need to move on. Can I take a question? Okay. Representative Gallego.
I did have just one question. The number you mentioned, 350 or so, what's the time frame for that with incidence or prevalence of cases? And then secondly, how do you define, how is your ID, the parameters of your identification?
So what we did was we looked at reports from Sexual Assault Research Center and DHS Chubbwell for Multnomah County, and the data was rich enough that we could ensure, because we had enough biographic detail in those reports, that we weren't double-counting kids. But each of those kids may have shown up repeatedly over the course of that four-year study. So what we did was just count each child individually, so not double-counting reports or incidents or anything like that. And we would just identify each child. And if you think about sex trafficking, though, it's not as if you could say there are 368 kids over 4 years, divide that number by four, and that's the number per year. Because at any given time, these kids are rotating between foster care, juvenile detention, home, relative, couch surfing, back on the street, back with the pimp, another city, this city. So it more helps you to look at the whole scope of the problem, that this is sort of the population of kids, because over the course of those 4 years, they're coming and going from the street. And then how we define sex trafficking, we only looked at minors, and we define minor as under 18, just like Oregon law. And we only counted kids who, the way that they identified as sex trafficking victims were that they had engaged in commercial sex with another person. So if they were paid money to have sex, that fits the definition of sex trafficking under federal law. Because whether or not, if you're an adult who pays a child for sex, whether or not they have a pimp, that's still sex trafficking, because it's commercially sexually exploiting a child. But most of these kids have pimps. I mean, just as an aside, the data did reveal, that they were being trafficked. I don't think there was a single one of them that didn't identify that they had been trafficked by another adult.
Stacy, can you, anything briefly?
Real briefly, my name is Stacy Ayers. I manage the Child Safety Program for the Department of Human Services. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I just wanted to recognize and reiterate what Ms. Marshall said, your leadership, and without it, we would not be in this place today. I've been involved in this process for the last probably 6 years, first coming to meetings on human trafficking at that time, that work groups that you were leading and pulling together people from the individual stakeholders and different areas of the government. So I appreciate that. And the department, as we move forward with this process, which this is, will continue to support our partners and being involved in this process of making sure that this vulnerable population of children is safe to the degree possible.
Thank you. Thank you for all your work in this process, Stacy. Great. Thank you very much. We're going to move on, colleagues, and we're going to do e-cigarettes first as Representative Barnard. Oh, great. He is here. Terrific. And Karen Gerard and Sarah Higginbotham. Terrific. Thank you so much. And so we have 15 to 20 minutes. And then we're just moving this around. We'll have children's mental health treatment issues after this. So thank you for coming, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11. I want to just simply remind people, because I think I've said this before, that I became involved in this issue almost by accident. I sat in an airport waiting room in June or July of last year next to a man who had this very strange-looking smoke, I thought it was, coming out of his mouth in a no-smoking area. And as I looked at it further, I realized he was smoking an e-cigarette. That's what got me interested. I later on asked the members of the legislature if anybody was bringing an e-cigarette bill. At the time that I was working on it, I didn't hear that anyone was. So I filed a bill that ended up in this committee in February. For a whole bunch of reasons, which I don't think we need to go into, that bill and one other that Representative Olson sponsored did not go anywhere. I am definitely not an expert on this issue, but I want to tell you tell the committee that under your leadership as a convener and chair of a work group, we have met over a number of months. We've had legislators, local government, state agency personnel, business interests, building owners and managers, an e-cigarette retailer who was actually quite helpful to us as we did our work, medical personnel, advocacy groups, the heart, lung, cancer groups, and as my notes say, a few other stragglers, researchers, and miscellaneous staff, including, by the way, alleged counsel in the person of Mark Mayer, who came to most of our meetings and was extremely helpful in helping us to define, to work on definitions so that we could actually prepare a bill that we think we're in pretty good shape on to move forward. I simply want to say that I haven't really learned a whole lot about this issue in this process, because what I needed to know was that tobacco and nicotine are extremely addicting drugs. that the time when people become addicted to them is during adolescence, sometimes even earlier, and that they cause enormous health problems and great difficulties for people, individuals. My own father died as a result of lung cancer, which I'm convinced came on because as a young man he was a very steady smoker. But I want to thank you, Madam Chair, for the work you've done in working this issue and getting it into shape. I counted 46 people who've been involved in this work group. I have 3 pages of email addresses on this group. So this has been a very extensively worked piece, and I'm very happy to have been involved with it. And I'd like to pass it on to the real experts and let them talk.
Great. Thank you.
Chair Tomei and committee members, Sarah Higginbotham, the Government Relations Director for the American Heart Association. I want to again echo Representative Barnhart's appreciation for bringing stakeholders to the table around this really important issue. Today I'd like to do 2 things. I'd like to remind committee members who, to my knowledge, have heard at least some about e-cigarettes, to remind folks what we mean when we say e-cigarettes. And 2, I'd like to highlight some of the most current research that is available and which underscores the premise for this work group. And afterwards, Karen Gerard from the Oregon Health Authority will share a little bit more about Oregon-specific data and the work group's progress. Just a reminder for everyone to take a big step back. Tobacco use is the number one cause of preventable death in Oregon, resulting in over 7,000 deaths a year and costing the state billions of dollars. E-cigarettes have caused a major shift in the landscape of tobacco control. E-cigarettes are battery-powered devices that contain a tank or a refillable tank or a cartridge containing a liquid that is composed primarily of, and let me make sure I pronounce this right, forgive me if I don't, propylene glycol and or glycerol and nicotine, as well as flavorings and chemicals. During use, a pressure-sensitive circuit heats and then turns the liquid into an aerosol that's inhaled through a mouthpiece and then exhaled as a fine mist. Most e-cigarettes do contain nicotine, which is derived from tobacco, and to echo Representative Barnhart, nicotine is a dangerous and highly addictive chemical, no matter what form it takes. The exhaled aerosol does not contain smoke, tar, or carbon monoxide, as combustible cigarettes do, but it does contain nicotine, and it does contain low levels of toxins. Just late last month, the American Heart Association issued a new statement and new research on e-cigarettes in our peer-reviewed journal, which I've passed out to committee members. This statement reviews the latest science, and I'd like to highlight, there's a lot of information there, but I'd like to highlight just 3 particular areas that I think underscore the work of this work group. Those 3 areas are public health, 2, youth, and 3, cessation. With regards to public health, it is worth noting and important to note that the long-term health effects of e-cigarettes are not yet known. Because e-cigarettes do not contain combustion products, some investigators believe that they might be less harmful than combustible tobacco, but there are no rigorous or long-term studies demonstrating their long-term effects relative to conventional cigarettes. Moreover, there are no regulations currently in place to ensure that the ingredients in e-cigarettes are clearly disclosed and non-toxic, and these ingredients vary widely by brand and can in some circumstances be varied by the user as well. Non-smokers could be involuntarily exposed to nicotine in any confined space where e-cigarettes are used. Additionally, unregulated e-cigarettes could turn back the clock to days when smoking was normal in public and seriously hamper current law enforcement around smoking in public places. As such, it is recommended that e-cigarettes be included in states' indoor clean air laws. 2, with regard to youth, recent studies raise serious concerns that e-cigarettes may be a gateway to traditional tobacco products for youth and could renormalize smoking in our society. Here's an important statistic to chew on: 1.78 million middle school and high school students as of 2012 have tried e-cigarettes. That's twice the rate as 2010, and those numbers continue to rise. In a study of over 40,000 middle school and high school students, those students believed e-cigarettes to be high-tech, convenient, and accessible, especially where smoking cigarettes is not currently allowed. And it's no surprise that they think that, since robust advertising and marketing efforts have been made. These have been advertised even during the Super Bowl on television and in magazines, using celebrities and a wide range of flavorings to appeal to the adolescents. And youth exposure to these advertisements has increased 250% from 2011 to 2013, just to give you an example. So I probably don't need to emphasize any more that it's strongly recommended that states prohibit access by minors to e-cigarettes, which Oregon currently does not, and approximately 26 states by our count have already done so. Finally, and to wrap up, just to highlight with regard to cessation, it is important to note that e-cigarettes are not currently approved by the FDA as a cessation device, and current evidence evaluating the efficacy of these devices as cessation aids is very sparse. There are concerns that e-cigarette use and acceptance of e-cigarettes have the potential to renormalize smoking behavior, sustain dual use, initiate or maintain nicotine addiction, and could serve as a gateway to reinitiation of smoking by ex-smokers. The recommendations of the AHA go beyond the scope of what this work group's actually working on, with proposals to actually curb the intense marketing and advertising of e-cigarettes, as well as banning flavoring. But with that, I'll pause there. You have the much longer scholarly article in front of you, and I'll pass it on to Karen.
I'm sure. Could you repeat that last statement? I didn't get it, what you said.
Sure, absolutely. The recommendations of the American Heart Association in total actually go beyond the scope of what this work group is proposing at the moment. And those further recommendations include curbing the intense marketing and advertising of e-cigarettes and banning...
The work group or the American Heart
Association? The American Heart Association.
Thank you.
And banning flavoring.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome. Go ahead, Karen.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. I'm Karen Gerard, the Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Prevention Section Manager at the Oregon Health Authority. I'm here today to present information about the use of e-cigarettes in Oregon and recent conversations about how to address e-cigarettes. Dr. Bruce Gutilius is also here, the Deputy State Epidemiologist, in case you have any questions about medical effects of e-cigarettes. As has been mentioned before, e-cigarettes are completely unregulated in the state of Oregon today. They are without safety protections, standards for product consistency, or truth in labeling requirements. The FDA states that e-cigarettes may contain ingredients that are known to be toxic to humans. It is of great concern that Oregon's children can legally access these addictive and unregulated products. Data show that current use of e-cigarettes among Oregon 11th grade students increased from 2% to 5%, a 150% increase from 2011 to 2013. Additionally, the Oregon Healthy Teens data show that more than 50% of current e-cigarette users in middle school and high schools in Oregon are not conventional smokers. A survey released by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and Disease Control and Prevention 2 weeks ago found that youth who have tried e-cigarettes were nearly twice as likely to say they would try a conventional cigarette. And given that age 12 to 26 years is the time during which most people start using tobacco, kids using e-cigarettes are being introduced to nicotine and are more likely to move on to cigarettes. Addressing age requirements for e-cigarettes is important, but evidence shows it will not be enough to by itself to keep e-cigarettes away from children. In Utah, where age restrictions for e-cigarette purchase and use have been in place since 2010, e-cigarette use has also more than doubled among kids, and they are three times more likely to have used e-cigarettes than adults. While local businesses and governments in Oregon have the authority to regulate e-cigarette sale and use, e-cigarettes can still be legally used in many places cigarettes cannot. That further offers an opportunity for smoking behavior to be modeled for kids as something that is normal anywhere, anytime. As Representative Barnhart and Sarah have talked about, the e-cigarette work group that's been meeting over the past few months is comprised of legislators, local government, state agencies, businesses, medical professionals, and advocacy groups, and we're pleased to be a part of that work group as well. The e-cigarette work group worked to address many of the complex issues that that have been raised here today, including the sales to minor issue and also including e-cigarettes in the Indoor Clean Air Act. And with that, thank you for the time, and we're happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. It's been a very, very difficult and complicated issue. Yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is to you, Sarah, since you represent the American Cancer or Heart Association. appreciate your testimony right now and your focus specifically on the youth aspect of this. I'm reading a report from your Rapid Access Journal report back in April of this year, and it deals with the impact of marijuana for increasing on heart complications in the middle-aged adults as well as the youth. We got Measure 91 right around the corner that we're dealing with. What stand are you taking toward that?
Thank you, Representative Olson, for the question. It's an important one. I can't at the moment speak for the American Heart Association's position with regards to the measure passing and marijuana use at the moment, but I'd be happy to get back to you and committee members. It's certainly on the top of my radar screen here in the state. What I think might be worth noting is what the work group itself has considered as we've worked on e-cigarettes in terms of these devices. We know that they e-cigarettes contain nicotine. We know that the device can also, the liquid that goes into the device can be changed. It can contain really whatever you'd like it to. And those considerations have been on the front of our minds as we draft legislation that might be applicable to marijuana usage.
Oh, can I have a follow-up?
Follow-up? I'm sure.
Okay. I guess I just want to nail this down a little bit more. Is your organization going to come out in opposition to Measure 91?
To my knowledge, no.
Okay. Thank you.
Colleagues, as Representative Barnhart pointed out, several legislators have been involved, including Representative Greenlee. Senators Monis Anderson and Steiner Hayward. Am I missing anybody here? And I know you were involved in the original bill that came before the committee earlier this year. So I think we're going to be, and right now we're looking at legislation, Mike is here somewhere, about from LC. So we're looking at a bill that might be 27 pages. It is a very difficult. It seems like it should just go under the Clean Indoor Air Act. Nothing is as simple as you'd like it to be.
That process had the biggest small group I've ever heard of.
I know it. We had over 50 people on the email list, and we said, well, we'll just have a small group that meets. At least 24 people showed up for the small group. It was amazing. But anyway, it's a wonderful process, and I think we're coming out with some good legislation. Representative
Thank you, Madam Chair. But Madam Chair, I must disagree. I join my colleague, Representative Olson, and I don't understand if you had this work group together, all the polls are indicating this is going to pass. And it's not even just going to pass as a bill. It's going to be part of the Constitution.
You're talking about marijuana. Okay, no, this really.
Statutory.
But we're not talking about marijuana in this. Sorry.
Yes, ma'am, but that work group should have done that, or you should have talked about secondhand
this
marijuana.
This is hard enough, working on this.
If I could, Madam Chair, just briefly in response to that, the work group did talk about a whole variety of issues, including that one, and what we did talk about was the fact that these devices could be used for a whole variety of different kinds of things, and part of the one of the things that the bill would do is essentially restrict the use of the device in public places, and you know get down to the details real fast, and I'm not going to try to do that here, because in one instance it might have nicotine in it, in another instance it might have marijuana in it, in another instance it might have something else altogether. It becomes an impossible regulatory process if you allow the device to have one kind of substance in it but not something else. So one of the things that I think this bill is probably going to say when it's finished would be that clean air is clean air, and you're not to use these devices in those places where smoking certainly is prohibited, and in public places, in the case of marijuana. So we did look at that issue. We did not address the issue of Measure 91 itself or the wisdom of it. That's something that people are going to tell us about pretty soon.
Thank you. Any other quick questions? Thank you so much. You've done fantastic work on this issue, so thank you so much. We look forward to legislation in January, February. So now we're getting here about children's mental health treatment issues. We've got, you're going to see up here? You certainly may. All right. Julie Magers and Jerry Gabay.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'll just introduce it as they're coming up. I don't want to take up their time because I know you have a very packed agenda.
Yes, we do.
But they have very compelling personal and professional experiences that build on a lot of what the previous panels have talked about in terms of what's not in the system that we need and what are things that are there that we can build on.
Terrific. Thank you, Representative. Go ahead.
Good morning, Chairperson Tomei, Vice Chair Olson, esteemed members of the committee. My name is Jerry Gabay. I have a JD from the University of Oregon. I am a member of the NAMI Oregon State Board of Directors. I'm co-chair of Providence Health System's Collaborative Council for Behavioral Health and co-author of the Oregon Psychiatric Physicians Association's Suicide Prevention Checklist, which you have been previously provided by committee staff, I believe. Dr. Stuart Newman and I received the Oregon Psychiatric Association's Access Award for 2013 for creating these documents. Most importantly, I am the father of a daughter afflicted by mental illness. This daughter. Please let me take a moment to tell you about her. Susanna was delightful from the moment of her birth. Pretty, cheerful, with a smile that was truly infectious. She loved to travel and was fluent in Spanish. She was a semifinalist in the 2006 Oregon State Speech and Debate Tourney, a pole vaulter and sprinter on the track team, and valedictorian of Hood River Valley High School in 2007. Yet early in her junior year in high school, she came home after having listened to a guest speaker in her health education class and asked us to take her to a counselor. She was diagnosed with clinical depression and given meds that did not ever seem to work well. In December of her senior year of high school, her counselor called us to say Susanna had been cutting herself and might be suicidal. The counselor arranged for her to be admitted to the secure adolescent psychiatric unit at Providence in Portland. Her 10 days in the unit appeared to help greatly. She returned home very much the same ebullient child that she had earlier been. But even though we were requested some sort of partial hospitalization or intensive outpatient program that would enable her to continue the group sessions and individual psychiatric visits that had been so helpful for her, no such program was available to us then, nor is it today. Back in the gorge, with very few mental health resources available, she slowly regressed. She was very proud of being accepted into the Honors College at the U of O with a presidential scholarship for full tuition, room, and board. But there she seemed to retreat more and more into herself. In the spring of 2010, just after her 21st birthday, she suffered a psychotic episode which resulted in her being placed in the secure psychiatric unit at Sacred Heart Hospital in Eugene. 1 month after her discharge, and 1 day after missing the only appointment with a psychiatrist that the hospital had ever made for her, she took her life. So why am I here today? Because I want to make you aware of three things which might have saved my daughter's life and which might save others in the future. The first would be much greater communication between providers and the families, and by families I mean by blood or affinity, of their patients. The problem is more than just HIPAA. In fact, it is far more, but we don't have time to discuss that, unfortunately, this morning. Even though some providers cannot think out of the HIPAA box, it's more a cultural issue. Providers are just not accustomed to communicating with families, largely due to a misunderstanding of HIPAA. And there is difficulty, if not impossibility, for them. There are billing codes available, but getting those codes paid for by insurance is difficult. So at a minimum, providers must be encouraged to seek authorizations to communicate with appropriate supporters of the patient and then actually communicate. And also, I might add, to use the exceptions, to learn about the exceptions in HIPAA, which are many. I'm on a panel tonight at St. Charles and Ben talking about that. To use those exceptions, which are in HIPAA, where the patient is deemed to be at risk for self-harm. I'll give you one example of, I said it's cultural, one quick example of this problem of lack of communication. At Sacred Heart in Eugene, Susanna did sign an authorization to communicate with her parents, as she always had done before. Her mother and I spent 8 days in Eugene in Easter week 2010. We repeatedly asked the staff when Susanna would be released and told them we wanted to participate in the discharge planning and, of course, be there when she actually got out of the hospital. On Easter Sunday, after seeing Susanna, we repeated that staff told us they had no idea, literally, when she was going to be discharged. So we said, well, we're going back home to resume our jobs. Please notify us. And they did. The next morning, they called her mother at 10 in the morning to say she had already been discharged without, of course, any communication with us. They discharged her without ensuring that she had an informed and present support system to help her transition and keep her alive. And again, the point is communication must become robust rather than ignored. A second issue is continuity of care, particularly for private insurance, because I'm sure you're aware that whatever Parity did, it did not require private insurance and OHP to provide the same services. So back to that issue of continuity of care, but by that I mean the availability of step-down programs that can continue the successes of more restrictive environments, which I mentioned earlier that we had requested after Susanna's stay at Providence during her senior year. Right now, for many children in this state, there are no good alternatives. And as I indicated, parents are not sufficiently involved by professionals so that they know what to do. We need incentives for the provision of care at higher levels than outpatient, but less intense than hospital setting. And the last of the three items is coordination of care or case management. Susanna left the hospital, and we, her parents, were provided no resources, no referrals to support groups, no information on her high risk for suicide. Training at the medical practitioner level for this must be improved, whether it be for primary care doctors, ER doctors, or actual mental health therapists and psychiatrists. Like many other rural teens, Susanna saw at least 8 different professionals in 3 different cities over 4 years. There was no one to coordinate her care so that she didn't drop through the cracks. Her mom and I might have, had anyone taken the time to communicate with us in depth as to the nature of her illness, the warning signs and risk factors, and actions that we could take to promote her recovery. We were the only ones with either the time or the level of concern to do this, but we were ignorant of what to do, as are so many other parents. We were well-educated parents in responsible professional positions who loved our child deeply, but we were not educated in this field. Mental illness knows no socioeconomic or educational distinctions. There could be a solution for this by requiring payment for case management to facilitate the smooth handoff between providers, and this would result in both lower costs ultimately and, more importantly, fewer deaths. Sadly, my story is not unique. I speak with numerous parents across the state, and this situation is more common than not. There are many small acts which the legislature could take to improve the situation, and we'd be happy to work with any of you who are interested. For now, I'd just like to say that although I am sad every day of my life, I am also deeply grateful for the presence of this brilliant, delightful child in my life. I hope that each of you and everyone else in a similar position may keep these lights alive in your lives, and I'm devoting the rest of my life to help make that come true. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I think on behalf of the whole committee, we extend our solicitude and our sadness at the loss of your daughter, and we hope that something will go forward in the future to help alleviate this situation.
Thank you, Chairperson Tomei.
Go ahead.
Hi there. Good morning, Chairperson Tomei, Vice Chair Olson, esteemed members of the committee. Suicide isn't easy to discuss because it touches our pain center so deeply and profoundly.
Could you give us your name, please?
I'm sorry, Julie Majors.
Thank you.
Thank you. I know because I talk to a lot of people about this as an employee with NAMI Multnomah, on multiple consumer advisory councils, and in the role I've taken on as an advocate for families. I'm impassioned about the topic because there are implications and consequences that families and young people experience as a result of us not being willing to earnestly explore doing better than we're currently doing. I want to thank Representative Gelser and others who are pushing on this topic in our state, and thank you all for the time you're taking to pay attention to this today. As Representative Gelser stated, unless we talk about it, it's very hard to find solutions to it. My name is Julie Majors. I'm the mother of two young adults who are thoughtful, kind, talented, and ambitious. My son is 23 years old and a master's student at U of O with a bright future ahead of him in physics. My daughter just turned 20. She works full-time at a veterinary clinic, and she just got a promotion to vet technician. She's gifted in working with horses, and she has a bright future ahead of her. Her ambition is to return to college and to work as a psychiatric nurse. 3.5 years ago, when she was just 16 years old, she'd been spiraling downward with anxiety and depression. In fifth grade, she struggled with social anxiety. In middle school, she was withdrawing into darkness and cutting herself. And by her junior year of high school, her only strategy left to relieve her own pain and anguish was suicide. She had not been entirely untreated. We were seeking guidance from many people to help her meet the day-to-day expectations of school, home, social life, and to address her health challenges. I heard concerns expressed by teachers and doctors. I'm really concerned about your daughter. Your daughter seems depressed and withdrawn, and if she works really hard this term, she can catch up. However, there were many barriers to getting the right care at the right time and with the right knowledge by providers. The night my daughter swallowed 3 bottles of acetaminophen, ibuprofen, and over-the-counter cold medicine, which was enough to destroy her kidneys and liver and to stop her heart from beating, I came to the hard realization that I was the only person who was going to act on the concerns and to fight to ensure that her needs would be met. At the ER, they stabilized her medically and then, without psychiatric assessment, told me they were preparing paperwork to discharge her back to home. I insisted on more intensive care and pushed back enough that they found a bed in acute care at Legacy Emanuel's Adolescent Psych Unit. In her 11 days there, they stabilized her, put her on a new trial of meds, and after a checklist of tasks that she completed with ease, they discharged her back to my care. They didn't do, in my opinion, a reasonable evaluation of her, and they definitely did not prepare me realistically for her increased risk of suicide. 2 weeks following that discharge, she had an explosive psychotic episode and a second suicide attempt. We returned to the same acute care where they stabilized her, weaned her off the meds, and prepared yet again for a discharge without adequate evaluation or a longer-term coordinated care plan. This time, I was unwilling to yield to the protocol to move her to the least restrictive setting and the barriers to a clinically appropriate step-down treatment plan. They found a replacement in a residential setting where I insisted on a thorough evaluation as well as my involvement in her treatment process. 30 days later, our entire team created a comprehensive care plan that considered her clinical, educational, and social needs, family supports, formal services, and informal community-based services. A year later, my daughter walked with her classmates and graduated high school with a regular diploma. We weren't free of more ups and downs in the years that followed, but what we did have were plans, we had strategies, we had tools, and we had resources to overcome any challenges that we did face. You might be asking yourselves, how did I know what to ask for and how to ask for it so that my daughter's and my family's needs would be met? And I can tell you that with my child's life on the line, with 2 suicide attempts within 1 calendar month, I pulled together everyone I knew who might play a role in helping us. In the years preceding, I'd been working for the Archimedes Movement, the nonprofit organization founded by Governor Kitzhaber to build public awareness and civic engagement around health reform. I worked for a woman who was very well versed in case management and the pitfalls of a broken healthcare system, who just 2 years prior had been immersed in the same children's mental health system with her own teenage son. I had a highly skilled therapist who was willing to work out a generous repayment plan for the dramatic increases in services that I needed from her. And I had a natural support system accessible to me that helped me learn what to say to whom and what to do at each juncture. They helped me through the most frightening and traumatic experiences of my life, and without them, I'd be telling you a different story today. With their help, both my daughter and I have learned how to advocate for reasonable and clinically appropriate care, to engage professionals, and to navigate the system. As you well know, very few families are in a position to tap similar resources. I've numerous details about what was helpful and what was harmful in how we've been treated over the past several years, and I tell these stories to motivate change. I tell the stories of what worked for us because I want that for others. If my daughter had not survived, you'd be hearing another tragic story, and we would all perhaps wonder helplessly, what do we do? My daughter's and my story shows what can be done, and that's why I keep telling it. As legislators, you do hold some power to shape the stories for families and young people to look more like mine rather than like that of my colleague Jerry's, stories of hope rather than despair and loss. The things that Jerry stated that might have made a difference for his daughter did make a difference for mine, in so much as I, the parent, was successful at insisting that they be implemented. Greater communication between providers and families, a continuity of care with clinically appropriate step-down treatments, meaningful inclusion of families and family preparation at discharges, and a comprehensive and integrated longer-term care planning approach. These best practices saved my daughter's life. However, very few parents know what these best practices are, nor have the natural supports or perhaps the personality to aggressively persist with a system that is not implementing the best practices of their trade. These produce better health outcomes. We believe what's called for is a genuine and in-depth dialogue that explores the implications of us doing the same things we're doing as compared to what is possible if we commit ourselves to creating real change. There are many people who are living these experiences and are willing to help inform the policy changes that can make a real difference for families in our state. I want to thank Representative Kenny Geyer for supporting us, making this presentation, and for all of you on your time and attention today on this topic.
Thank you so much for coming and sharing your story with us, and we're happy to hear that your daughter is on a road to recovery. Thank you, and thank you, Representative Kenny Geyer. And also, Representative Gelser, I know this has been a big issue for you, both of you.
Madam Chair, I just want to thank both of you again and say that we are going to be working on a bill concept or concepts having to do with some of these ideas. And if anyone else is interested in working on that, please let me know.
Great. All right. Thank you so much
thank
for coming.
You. Thank you very much.
We'll be moving on to the update on restructuring the Oregon Housing and Community Services. Representative Gallegos, are you going to stay up here?
I will.
And Margaret Van Fleet. Nice to see you again, Margaret.
And just to get us going, I'll just introduce our topic. And Margaret's been working on this for some time, and we're making headway. And
good.
A great... Well, two-page handout, but should be able to bring us up to date. Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. Again, my name is Margaret Van Vliet. I'm the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. Very glad to be here in front of this group again just to provide you a quick update on what's happening with my agency. You do have in the meeting materials this two-pager that Representative Gallegos referenced. It's a quick recap. There's lots of detail that sits behind it, as you can well imagine. What I would recall for you is the long process that we engaged in throughout most of 2013. I was in front of this committee a number of times talking about the process, the analytics, the community engagement, and kind of the guiding principles. all of which led us to conclude that we do in fact need an agency committed to the issue of affordable housing. Certainly today's informational meeting that you've hosted underscores that yet again. But that we do need that agency to be refocused and to sort of see its role in a different way than it has historically. And so that was the kind of summary result of all of the work of 2013. So we took those learnings, and we've been focused internally on strategic planning and thinking about, well, how should we operationalize all of what we heard and learned and saw throughout 2013? And so that's what we've been working on. And the summary page will give you kind of the framework that we're using to redesign the agency, to refocus our work, and to utilize policy, to utilize data and research in new and different ways to move forward. So I know you're short on time. I won't read the new vision and mission and values statement there. I would say are not radically different from what the agency has operated with for a number of years, but I think they are a refinement that is helpful to my agency in helping us think about our role. I would just spend a couple of minutes talking about what we're calling these three-year strategic imperatives. If we're going to refocus our agency and deliver services differently to Oregonians in a more integrated way, what are the things we need to do as an agency to help drive that agenda? And so we've carved out five strategic imperatives. My leadership team is just about to finalize kind of the tactics and strategies and the one-year and three-year sort of outcomes that we want to drive towards. So these are at the very highest level. But they certainly start with this development of an effective integrated policy and governance model. Many of you will recall the what I fondly call the spaghetti chart of all the various bodies who give us policy advice for various streams of funding. And so we've taken up this idea that we need to move towards a single integrated policy body, and we have a legislative concept working its way through the system that will drive us towards that. Won't get us down to one in the 2015 session, but we think we'll make good progress. We've labeled the next strategic imperative, deliver remarkable service. That sort of simple phrase belies, I think, the complexity of that. But this imperative really speaks to the idea that we think of our role not as being so much a regulator or a compliance sort of officer, although we still have to do that. But that we more and more see ourselves as facilitating local efforts, local and regional efforts around prosperity and community and economic development. And that we have to sort of develop a service culture, if you will, that helps my employees see their role in that different way. So there's a lot of work underneath that remarkable service sort of concept that we have to operationalize. I think we also identified that we need to think of ourselves as playing a different leadership role and, frankly, attracting, developing, and retaining the talent we need in the long term to drive this agenda internally. So we've got a number of tactics and strategies that will help us in that regard over the next few years. At the heart of a lot of the redesign and the conversations I had with this body were about the business model and the fact that it was fiscally unsustainable, which I think prompted a lot of my initial questions when I came to the agency about 3 years ago now. And so certainly there's a lot of effort that needs to go into understanding our business model, our many, many complicated revenue streams. How do we report on them? What tools do we use to make management decisions and, frankly, to show a different level of accountability to the legislative body and to other decision makers? We have a long way to go there, but I feel like we're on a good path to drive towards this fiscal sustainability, both understanding what we've got and driving towards a system where our costs to operate are matched to the available revenue we have to do that. And finally, we want to keep an emphasis on becoming data and research driven. We have access to lots of different data points, but it's hard to see how they add up to a clear policy direction about where we set our priorities, which housing projects should we invest in, which kind of community service grants are the most impactful for people on the ground. We want to really get at this question of data and research as being drivers of the work that we do. So that's a high-level overview. Again, it's there's a lot of detail that sits underneath that. But I would characterize our work now and for the next few months as being pretty internally focused, and that my goal is to help my agency kind of make the culture shifts and the service delivery shifts that we need to do to deliver on what we all said were kind of the desired future state characteristics. So I'll stop there and be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Gallegos?
I don't have a question so much as just wanting to recognize the hard work that went into really pulling this all together. And I think you're right, sort of a new lens on the culture of housing and recognizing how integral housing is as part of the discussion we're having, whether it's mental health or poverty or whatever, that we really need to think about this whole notion of affordable housing very differently than we have. So thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Any other questions? Yes, Representative Leiden.
Thank you. You know, I just want to thank you and recognize that over the 14-15 years that I've known you and been aware of your work, I've consistently seen you to be one of the highest capacity people we have in public service in Oregon, and the fact that you have brought your careful attention and your commitment to excellence to this incredibly important state housing agency makes me feel optimistic about where we can go with it, and I just want to thank you for taking on the work.
Thank you very much.
Housing underlies so much of what it is that we deal with, whether it's mental health issues, all kinds of things. And so poverty, people being able to have a job, living close to the job and having transportation to get there. So I think this is so important, a difficult issue that you've taken on. I commend you for keeping on with this, but it must be, I mean, I think of all that spaghetti. How do you get it all together? Maybe make a roast out of it. I don't
there
know.
You go.
But good luck with you. Thanks for coming again today, Margaret. Any further questions? All right. Thank you very much. We're moving on to our next issue, which is... Okay. Steve Manella, thank you so much for coming today. Integrating disparate housing services.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. And I wanted to thank Representative Nathanson for having me come today and talk to you about the work that we're doing in Lane County. At the heart of the work that we're doing in Lane County is that we're trying to solve a problem that shouldn't be a problem and should be solvable, and that is we should be able to end homelessness among children in our county. And we're doing that by using technology and coordinating with agencies locally. So my name is Steve Manella. I'm the director of Human Services for Lane County, and I'm here to give you an update on the innovative ways that Community Action is coordinating services with DHS to address homelessness among children. As you know, eligible TANF households have extremely low incomes, and finding safe, affordable ways to live is often very difficult, yet it's critical to achieving their long-term goals. We use a best practice in Lane County called rapid rehousing, and it is part of a housing first model. And the idea is that we get people into housing first, and then we work on all their other issues. Only when a family is safe from the elements can they focus on barriers like employment? And in the state of Oregon, unfortunately, there are close to 23,000 children that get up every morning to homelessness. When you think about the population of the state, it's not an enormous number, and it's something that should be achievable for us to work on as a state. In Lane County, what we have implemented is something called coordinated entry. And Margaret spoke earlier of the spaghetti chart. Those of us who work in human services and housing, we work with many different funding streams. We work with many different organizations. We work within a community with many talented providers. And what the challenge is to deliver the service to the end user in the most efficient way, the most efficient and effective way. We've done that in Lane County through coordinated entry. And what that is it's a concept where we have front doors to service. So rather than a consumer going around from one agency to another or calling one agency and then calling another, we have front doors through access centers, community service centers, and through shelters, specialized services for victims of domestic violence, child abuse, mental illness. And each of the people who enter the system only get one assessment, only end up being case managed by a case manager of one organization or a team of case managers. This is accomplished through a software called Service Point. We chose to go along with the City of Portland and Multnomah County and others and go with a software that's used by 50% of the folks around the United States. So we didn't have to build something for Oregon. We could take something off of the shelf, state of the art, and deploy it in our community. As a result, we've been able to get more families into housing. This year alone, we have been able to take the TANF housing program and a program, a new program that you all funded through the SPRF program, Strengthening and Preserving and Reunifying Families, coordinate that with our community action agencies, DHS offices, WorkSource offices, and housing service providers, and get families into housing. I'll give you an example. We have families who go through the child welfare system, do everything that they need to do, and go through their treatment program, meet all their goals. They can't afford housing. They can't get their children back until they have housing. Through this PERF program, we've been able to make that happen. The other thing that this does is by being coordinated between the resources that we get from Housing and Community Services and DHS and from the federal government, what it allows us to do is it allows us to maintain one eligibility. So when your state resources run out for a household, we can continue to serve them with the HUD resources. This model isn't new. The state of Utah has deployed this model. Other states have deployed the model, and it's been highly successful. So I want to thank you all today, and thank you very much.
So I have a question. So who is funding this program?
The funding comes from HUD, local county funds, state emergency housing account funds.
So we heard from Margaret Van Fleet just a minute ago when we talked about the spaghetti. This is one of the spaghetti parts. Is that true?
Yeah, this is really somebody said earlier, braiding funds. But what we're attempting to do is put together a system that takes all that complexity and simplifies it so that we can then deliver the service in the best way possible.
So is there any other community in Oregon that is doing this? You mentioned the state of Utah. Anybody else in Oregon doing this?
Multnomah County has elements of this. We're further along in coordinated entry than other communities in the state of Oregon. It's a very difficult task because you have to be able to get all the organizations to cooperate. You have to get a willingness also to open up the management information system so that agencies that are working in tandem can actually see what services and see case notes that are being written by other agencies within one system.
And that traditionally is so difficult throughout not just governments but throughout agencies also, and certainly in the medical profession that's an issue. Representative Leininger?
Thank you. Am I right that Bridges to Housing, which was a bi-state, four-county effort maybe 5-6 years ago, also worked on trying to integrate care delivery using the housing, the homeless management information system? It seems like a great idea. I'm glad to hear as many groups as possible are doing
it. Yeah, I think Bridges to Housing had done that as well.
That's great.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Oh, thank you. Well, we were just hearing about the challenges with HIPAA, so I'm curious about how you're meeting the challenges of the need for privacy among
clients. I think, you know, in this case, this is not healthcare information that we have within this database. So, you know, for example, you may be able to look at an assessment that's done and somebody has indicated that there's a member of their household with mental illness, but you won't be able to find any information about the treatment that person is receiving. So and I've worked in healthcare as well, and so you know, we have safeguards so that you know, this isn't an integration of electronic medical records with human services. Mm-hmm. It's the housing and human services piece.
Representative Olson, do you
thank
have
you, Madam Chair. Yeah, Steve, I just a real quick question. Looking at the definition on what homelessness is from the Homeless Council nationally. And one of the things that I see that part of the criteria is it deals with staying in a motor vehicle. Do you have any ballpark idea of what the percentage is of the kids of that 23,000 that you mentioned here in Oregon stay in a motor vehicle?
I do not. The Department of Education has the best information on child homelessness in Oregon, and certainly there is a category called not meant for habitation, and within that category you would find folks that are living in motor vehicles, and it's you know, it's a very unfortunate situation. It just makes me sad because you know, we hear these stories daily, and we know that housing is a barrier. We know that some of the people who end up going to that length, they've been through the TANF program, they've been through the jobs program. You know, they might have be working in the community at minimum wage. It takes 157% of a TANF grant in order to maintain a two-bedroom apartment. And that's why, you know, states like Utah have looked at the rapid rehousing, the rent support, and then coupling that with employment and training programs, you know, to get people where they need to be so that they can sustain housing and make that investment.
How many clients do you serve?
In Lane County, we serve close to 9,000 people a year who are homeless. In our poverty programs, we serve over 70,000 people a year. In Lane County, we have currently we have the third highest poverty rate. Our poverty rate in Lane County is around 22%. And so for an area with a large metropolitan population, we have a considerable amount of poverty. Our unemployment rate is about average with the state. Mm-hmm. So like a lot of other communities, what we have going on is we have, as jobs are coming back, they don't pay as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. Thank you so much. We appreciate what you're doing. Appreciate you sharing your story with us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Next, we're going to be hearing Supportive Housing Facility, David Fuchs, Howard Klink, and Rachel Duke. Okay, who's going to speak to us first?
That would be me. Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
Members of the committee. My name's David Fuchs. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Cedars-Sinai Park, and we're here to talk to you about our Housing with Services initiative. With me is Rachel Duke from Home Forward and Howard Klink, who's the Housing with Services Project Director. And Rachel, I guess you've got the mouse there, so if you could go to the next slide, just click it.
David, you have no more than 15 minutes.
We'll be very
fast.
We're going
to say 10, and allows time for questions.
Thank you. So when I first entered the business of human services over 40 years ago, the executive officer of the organization I went to work for said, "Welcome to this crazy business," and I thought he meant the clients. But what I discovered very quickly was the least crazy part of the business was the clients. What was crazy was that there were all of these silos of service with different regulatory structures and functions, and it made it almost impossible for clients to wend their way through the system of care and to be able to provide services for them. The Housing with Services Initiative was developed as an effort to take a look at the health care needs of elders and people with disabilities in affordable subsidized housing provided through contracts with HUD, and to recognize the unique health care needs of that population and to try and develop a more coordinated approach to developing services for that population. The first slide that that you see is one that sort of points out the level of demand and the level of need. And most interesting to me is that the elders in affordable housing are significantly more vulnerable than same-age elders living on their own in apartments. And even more challenged than elders living in their own homes. The Housing with Services Project was developed as an opportunity to take a look at how we might coordinate healthcare and social services for that population in order to prevent them from needing to use emergency rooms unnecessarily, repeat hospitalizations unnecessarily, and to fall into the long-term care system. This is not long-term care. It is community-based healthcare that we are about providing. Our project is a pilot project focusing on trying to prove whether this model works. If it does, we hope to work with the state on developing administrative rules to be able to create a structure which can make it possible to implement on a replicated basis. Everything we're doing is being funded through either contributions from foundations, through our own contributions in creating an LLC, or through this, the SIM grant that the state was able to bring in to be able to do a project that really is a public domain project that would ultimately be replicable. We started down this path in 2011 and started a conversation at the state level. There was a summit held, and we received remarkable support from the Oregon Health Authority, from the Department of Human Services, and the governor's office, and have been moving forward and planning ever since. We were able to pull together in 2013 an LLC see, and you'll be hearing a little bit about the number of providers who have stepped up to become part of this LLC. The reason behind the LLC was to create a level of discipline among providers to be able to collaborate with each other and to work together effectively, and not only providers, but provider housers and health insurers are working on this project together, and we're very pleased to be moving forward. I'm going to throw the ball to Howard to talk a little bit more.
Okay, Howard Klein, Project Director for Housing and Services. Why don't you give me, well, the first thing I want to tell you about is the what David has described, the kind of program and policy framework we're using to construct the design of this project is a social determinants of health model. We're looking at a broad range of health indicators beyond just hospitalization and emergency room use to make a determination and measure whether the project will be successful. Community inclusion, use of transportation, access to mental health services, access to culturally specific services, a focus on improved access for a broad range of people with disabilities are some of the social determinants of health, among the social determinants of health indicators that we're looking at. Let's go to the next slide. What you've got in front of you on this slide is a more detailed outline of all the project goals that we're focusing on, but the metrics that we're going to be looking at and measuring among them are reduced use of hospital stays, which are highly expensive healthcare costs, reduced use of ER, and deferred or delayed movement towards institutional care. And the program components that we have in place, we believe are going to support achievement of those metrics. This slide in front of you really, and these are some high-level program headlines that I'd like to focus on. We've got 11 Section 8 buildings primarily located in downtown Portland. We've got some buildings that are, one building in particular that's a little bit outside the downtown core, that house 1,500 seniors and people with disabilities. And the primary project goal is to bring in health navigators, care coordinators, services that are available in the community, improve healthcare access to Medicaid-funded services, and greatly broaden in an integrated services context what's available to all 1,500 people that live in these buildings. We're working closely with the coordinated care organizations, and I'll hold on to that for a little bit later. We do have a health care center, a clinic, in one of the buildings that's kind of central to the location of the 11 buildings that will house healthcare staff, social services delivery staff, and be a site for a broad range of activities that will be available to the building residents. So those are the primary high-level program elements. We'll give you a little bit more information about the funding source and how we've constructed the LLC as we go through the rest of the presentation.
What I want to emphasize here is that client choice is at the center of this. This is person-centered care. People get to opt in or opt out depending on whether they want to participate. This is also a project that's being evaluated by Portland State University's gerontology program and School of Social Work, so that we'll be able to put together a meaningful report to be able to say this is what the data shows us works and does not work. I'm sorry.
This is an operation now, am I?
That is correct.
Okay.
And one other piece to add to what David just said is we, from the very inception of the project, before we even had the full design constructed, we set up a resident advisory council, which includes residents from all the buildings that are participating in the project. They've assisted us with program design, input on what services should be available. They've helped design the evaluation and survey instruments, and they're involved in ongoing oversight, implementation, and actually some project support with the project. And we've got a very, very active group of, a diverse group of residents.
So if you look at that.
This is publicly funded, but also some private funds? Are we talking
That's
about?
That's correct.
That's correct. Yeah, we have.
So what proportion?
About $400,000 in public funds and about $900,000 in private funds have been brought to bear to make
wow.
this work.
And this is especially an issue I know important to represent Gilliam.
Yeah, it's definitely a public-private
That's
partnership
great.
In that sense.
Good.
So, Rachel.
So the partnership piece is super important. I'm Rachel Duke from Home Forward. I'm the Supportive Housing Program Director there. We're the housing authority that serves Multnomah County. We're one of the partners here in the slide, including there's some mental health providers, Cascadia, LifeWorks, Jewish Family Child Service is also providing mental health services. Sinai Family Home Services and Care Oregon. Care Oregon, a really important member of this project, and Asian Health and Service Center. As Howard said, there's a focus on culturally specific services as well. So one of the reasons, or an important reason, that Home Forward is interested in doing this is because we know how important housing with services is. We house 15,000 households throughout Multnomah County. It's 33,000 folks, and we are kind of responsible for operating about 6,200 units. We have 11 high-rise buildings, and in those buildings, they're dedicated to folks who are either elderly or disabled. And we know that housing with services, housing is an important platform for many, many people to get their lives together. And for some folks, it's you need more than housing. Housing is an important and absolutely necessary, but not always the sufficient ingredient. The most frequently we need more, like connection to resources around services, mental health, healthcare, food security. So housing is important, but an insufficient ingredient sometimes for a whole family stability. So we are always looking for creative and sustainable ways to link housing with services, providing that housing platform and bringing those services in. Housing. So we're excited to be here as part of this project. It's gives us an opportunity to take four of our buildings and look at a way, creative and potentially very sustainable way, to bring resources into the building to support residents who, like every other community that we have in our and our country, is filled with folks who are aging. And we want to make sure that we're giving people the opportunity to age at home in their apartments in a really dignified and respectful way. And so this is one opportunity we have to help to make that happen. And we're excited also to be a member of the limited liability company, which is a way that we are participating. We have some shared decision-making in terms of how the program works, and it's a pretty efficient way to manage this project.
Thank you very much. This is very exciting.
The next slide lays out the financial path. So just to illuminate a little bit, there are $440,000 from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid that have come into the project, grant funds from Enterprise Community and the Harry and Jeanette Weinberg Foundation and the Hedco Foundations were brought to bear. In addition, all of us who are participating in the LLC have made the equity contributions and have skin in the game also. So you can see this really is a public-private partnership. What we're trying to look at is there a private sector method of coordinating services in an effective way that will help people to stay at home, keep them out of the hospital, keep them out of long-term care, and help them to have the services in the community that they desire. This is one of those places where good policy and the desire of the clients come together in a very effective way, and it can ultimately be more cost-effective. We know with the coming boomer cohort that the demand will far exceed our capacity to build institutions. Our institutions are very important. I happen to run a few of them. But we cannot just be in the business of putting people into beds. We have to be in the business of helping people to stay home and age in place and succeed in the community. And this is about doing that and providing a level of coordination among the various providers in the community so that we can work effectively with the healthcare system. Howard, do you want to talk about project development and the enterprise efforts?
Yes, just two quick things in closing. David mentioned the limited liability company, which was constructed as an administrative entity to operate it. He mentioned the funding sources, but I think it's worth noting that the equity shares, Cedars-Sinai is the largest equity shareholder. It's worth noting that Care Oregon is an LLC partner and the second largest equity contributor to the company. Home Forward is third. Then we have a group of smaller contributors, Cascadia Behavioral Health, LifeWorks Northwest, Jewish Family and Child Services, Sinai Family Home Services, and the Reach Community Development Corporation, all as partners and equity shareholder contributors. And as I'm sure you are all aware, Care Oregon has a vested interest in reduction of Medicaid costs as part of health share. So those dots are connected. Lastly, we have the latest, and some of these are hot off the presses. We had a resource fair in our 1,200 building clinic yesterday, and nearly 200 people showed up. All the service, nearly all the service providers that are going to be present in the buildings were reaching out to clients, doing recruitment and doing enrollment. We have people enrolled in the project as of yesterday. We have a primary care physician who will be in the clinic a couple of days a week. We have Providence Elder Place running their PACE program out of the clinic space 2 days a week, and Asian Health and Service Center will have case managers in the location as well. Finally, just to give you a sense of this project's connection to a larger effort, Enterprise Community Partners, which is a nationally based housing developer and foundation, is funding a national learning collaborative that includes projects from 12 states. Cedars-Sinai is a project that's participating in that, and their Portland office has eight funded projects locally, one from Lane County as of a couple of weeks ago. That are doing similar work in earlier stages of development, and there's a learning exchange and collaborative that's basically helping development of best practices.
And last, a few of the commonly asked questions. How will resident choice be addressed? We are making it, this is an opt-in model, and the focus is give residents choice about what services they would like, and if they would like us to coordinate with their existing service providers, we're happy to do it. That's our responsibility. Difference between housing with services and assisted living is a radical difference. I happen to run a 161-bed assisted living apartment building. It is a very different care contract, a different structure, and a different set of rules. This is affordable housing where housing is inspected by HUD. People have a much higher level of privacy and independence, and our goal is simply to foster that independence and support it. And how will home care services be regulated for housing with services participants? Our home care service provider in the LLC is a licensed provider. We will work with any licensed providers, including the SEIU providers. Anyone who is licensed and capable of providing service, we're more than happy to work with. But the key is that we're operating under the regulatory arms of the state. That's our story, and we're sticking with it.
It's a great story. Thank you so much for coming and presenting this to us today. It's very exciting.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I do have one question.
Sure.
When will you have some evaluation data, some outcome data?
The initial assessment has been completed and is being reported to HUD as of October 1. We anticipate by the end of the next federal fiscal year, we will see evaluative data begin to come together and have a formal report. And we're really pleased that Paula Carter from PSU is the primary investigator here.
Great. We'll have some preliminary data, I think, prior to that. Along the way, we'll be pulling
okay.
some data.
Look forward to it.
We'll be happy to come back with it.
Yeah.
Good. Thank you so much.
Thank you
for having us. We appreciate it.
And now, John Mullen, we have you and Erica Miller and Karen Solarius. Am I pronouncing that remotely correctly?
Yes, you are.
Good. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
Members of the committee, for the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I'm going to be very brief today. I attached my testimony from the 2014 session where we got funding for this particular study. So really what I'm here to do is just to say thank you first to the legislature as a whole for funding this, but I also want to thank my colleague Erica Miller and DHS for their cooperation, and for Karen and Mary from the Regional Research Institute. You'll hear from them in a moment. But just to sum up, you know, since 2005, we have not had funding for services for people who are described as the poorest of the poor. We're not adequately serving that population. But I can't end my testimony without saying that this committee has been so very focused and supportive of this issue since 2007, when I first went to work for the Oregon Law Center. Several of you on the committee were around right from the beginning, and I just have to also just single out you, Madam Chair, as being so very supportive and responsive and having a vision about making this happen, that we hope we have a placeholder bill to talk about what pilots might be proposed going forward, and in the end, just hope to make you proud of the efforts that we have all engaged in over all of these years. Thank you very much.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Erica Miller. I'm a program manager with the Department of Human Services Aging and People with Disabilities Collaborative Disability Determination Unit. And my testimony will be very brief as well. I did submit written testimony, so I hope that you have that. I really wanted to just confirm today that the department has contracted with Portland State University's Regional Research Institute to conduct this study. And I know that they'll be sharing information with you today. And I'm also here just to answer any questions you may have for the department.
Thank you. I want to remind the committee, we've heard this over and over again. These are the folks who can be getting Social Security payments, but they need the help of the state in order to do that. And so it's not a very big pot of money. And when they are able to get Social Security, then they pay the state back. So this is one of those situations where it makes so much sense to us that we need to reinstitute this program.
Thank you, Madam Chair and representatives of the committee. My name is Karen Solarius, and I'm a senior research associate at the Regional Research Institute for Human Services at Portland State University. The RRI is part of the School of Social Work at PSU, and we've been around for about 40 years. So my colleague, Mary Oswald, and I have been asked to conduct this study for the Aging and Disabilities, People with Disabilities Collaborative Disability Determination Unit. And I've submitted some testimony, and there's also a one-page description of the study. As you can see from the information, we're about halfway through the study, and we started in June, and we're planning on having a report available in January of 2015. And what we're looking at is we have a number of research questions that we've been asked to look into. One is what already exists within Oregon and in other states related to temporary cash assistance, and what is the need today in Oregon since the program has not been around for a while, and what potential structures and funding options might address the needs of the target population while also addressing any barriers that were experienced in the previous program. And we're also looking into what pilot programs might be considered. So we have a number of different data sources, including historical documents and studies, including studies done related to other states. And we're also talking with people in other states that have similar programs. We're interviewing childless adults with disabilities who might qualify or have qualified in the past for this program. And also we're talking with a number of direct service providers, administrators, and other key informants. So we're being guided by staff from the Collaborative Disability Determination Unit, as well as an advisory committee that represents people with disabilities, senior services, housing, food assistance, social services, corrections, and also veterans. So we are looking forward to having the findings available in January, and thank you again for allowing us to speak with you today.
Thank you, Karen. Mary.
I work with Karen. I'm an associate professor of research in the School of Social Work. I have been at RRI with Karen. Like Karen said, we are taking the lead on talking to both consumers who either had received temporary cash assistance prior to it.
Mary, I don't think you introduced yourself.
Oh. Maybe.
Thank you. Mary Oswald, work at the Regional Research Institute. I'm an associate professor in the School of Social Work at Portland State University, working with Karen on this study. The role that I'm playing in the study is to talking to consumers who would be eligible for services if a temporary cash assistance program was reinstated in Oregon. I've also talked to folks who had received the GA funds prior to it being taken away, if you will, in Oregon, asking them current needs, what gets in the way of waiting for disability benefits if they've applied, what that wait means to them, how do they keep their lives afloat if it's a month, if it's a year, if it's sometimes even 3 years waiting for federal assistance, and what the measures that they put in place. We've heard testimony today that housing is a real need. I continue to hear that from folks around the state, whether they live with family, whether they are homeless, whether they choose to do shelter kind of care. Family did speak about living in an automobile for several months between the time that she applied for disability benefits and the time she actually received that. So I think this study is getting a current look at current needs, as well as what it might take for program administrators to take this up and reinstate it. And hopefully, in a pilot project that comes next year, we can answer some of those questions of what the need is and how to address barriers that continue to play out in families getting these assistance dollars. And like you had said, it's adults who are homeless without children. Sometimes those kids are grown up and the needs come now because of an accident on the job. So whether it be a physical disability, a mental health disability, or a combination of the two, needs are quite complex. And as the aging population continues, it's compounded by the effect of that aging. And another element that I'm hearing from consumers is the context of the situation today is different than, you know, mid-2000s. We do have a coordinated care element that they are sometimes receiving some stopgap measures there, but not everything is being readily addressed. So we're encouraged by people readily coming forth and talking to us about their current needs and really looking forward to trying to put a pilot project together to specifically try a model, whether it's housing-based or some kind of combination with a CCO. Heard from folks both as administrators and consumers of a wraparound model where it would be one portal addressed of not having so many people to go to for where to go for housing, where to go for food support, where to go for coordinated care, that it's less cumbersome, if you will, that the noise of access is placed in one physical location that is structurally, physically accessible, as well as coordinated care approach. So it's been a great project, and we're learning a ton, even in just the small amount of time that I do think people demonstrating their willingness to talk to us speaks to their, I think, their need and their encouragement to have some services reinstated.
Mary, how do you find somebody to talk with you about these issues?
That's a good question. So, for example, I did a number of interviews down in Eugene, and we asked DHS to, in those areas, to ask to maybe put up a flyer, or when you're having a community meeting, say that this study is being conducted. So it could be a piece of paper or a verbal advertisement. On that verbal advertisement or the piece of paper, my name and telephone number is there. So a woman in a housing facility called me up and she said, I will reserve a community room. I will post a flyer in my housing facility. I showed up on a Sunday and I did seven interviews. So the people, if you go to where I think a small bit of advertising and the people are realizing that this potentially will be reinstated in their lives, that's one example. Another example was down in Medford, the Centers for Independent Living, the CILs. There's one in Grants Pass, and Medford had a DHS town hall meeting. So I'd gone to the DHS town hall meeting. I had met with the executive director of the Center for Independent Living in Medford. He, in his consumer base, literally just sent out an email with our recruitment flyer, and this study has been approved, much like other studies at PSU, by an institutional review board. So the things that we send out for advertisement are approved for research purposes. The Medford executive director, there was four men the next day who came to the Job Corps, all had spinal cord injury, readily talked to me about their access, their accident, their connection with Providence Healthcare in working with the social worker there who was very key in helping them retain and get disability benefits. That was really seamless. So it spoke to me of one advocate who knew what she was doing, who knew her patient load, and they had services compared to others I talked to who that health coordinator or that liaison person isn't there, and the morass of service delivery can be really confusing and kind of just shut you down for where to go and who to talk to.
Really exhausting. Any quick questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John, would you remind me of the funding level when we stop this for some unknown reason?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam. The cost associated with the program, there was a cash assistance grant at that time of $314 a month, and then it was the case management support that helped people qualify for the disability benefits. The people were already receiving Medicaid services. Sometimes that got added on, but we were able to get an agreement to say, that those are costs that would happen in any case. And now that people are, you know, under the Affordable Care Act, you no longer have to prove a disability in most instances. You just simply have to prove that you're poor. So so while people can get health care, and Mary talked about how this works with the CCOs, if you can imagine, the CCOs have people now in their charge. They have this person-centered approach that they're supposed to take on, and they have people with no income and no place to live. And so without having the kind of stability that would be possible by going ahead and recreating this kind of mechanism, people go without, and they don't have that instance to stabilize. So the cost, again, would be for if we did cash assistance and or a housing voucher, the case management support, and then the health care costs are already built in. So on an individual basis, I don't have an exact number about what that would be. But as the chair pointed out, there are some of those services that when we put the money out in advance can be reimbursable. In the last instance of general assistance, 70% of the money that was put out for the cash assistance for those people came back to the state in reimbursements.
Is that what you were asking, Representative Gilliam?
I was asking how much Ways and Means was putting out in 05 and stopped for 07. Right. And when you look at that number, which if you can give me the ballpark.
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, I wish I could give you the ballpark. The part of the problem was that it was inflated with the health care number, which we finally got an agreement about.
I understand.
But also, one of the things that makes this a complicated budgetary issue is that when the money returns from the federal government, it may return in the next biennium. So anytime this program is restarted, there'll be some front-end money that will return to the state.
It'll come back.
So I think that's an excellent question. John, can you research that and get that to us? Because I think that's a really good question.
In conclusion of my thought, Madam Chair, yes, everything we talk about in here can get complicated. I think, despite the complications and the important work that you're doing to justify restoration of this, this is really simple and ought to be something we focus on. You think of all the things we heard today. This is a simple one. And I would urge this committee to the Ways and Means Committee on Human Services to fund this in 15. It's that simple. It's that important. I'm not going to call it a Band-Aid. It's far more important than it. But it's a great lever and a great bridge to all the kinds of people we've been talking about today.
And we need to know what that figure was and what it might be.
But
today,
it will be quite doable when we look at the universe of Ways and Means spending.
Yeah. Good point. Representative
I was looking at your timeline. So, my assumption is that we'll get the report in January and you have a placeholder, and then we'll be looking forward to then some legislation. But I did have a question in terms of the research. You know, this afternoon we're celebrating a signing of a racial impact statement bill that we passed last time, and it's very exciting but unfortunate that we need a bill to remind legislators to look at racial impact. And so I'm curious about the degree to which your study is going to accommodate or include racial impact.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we are trying to be as broad as possible in our collection of information for this study. So we are taking special care to get input from all regions around the state, as well as all demographics of the potential consumers. So we are very specifically targeting, looking at people based on race and ethnicity, as well as age group, gender, and veteran status. So we're hoping to have a pretty broad representation and a broad set of information for the report.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other quick questions? Look, we've got 2 minutes left. Thank you so much. Keep us abreast of what's happening. We'll see you in January. They will see you in January. But bless you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Committee, you are the best. You are.
That's really
yay for our chair.
Oh, yay for our chair. You are. I just love you guys. And you stay right here for 3 hours. I mean, many of you left for a few minutes, but not much. So thank you so much. Minutes, but not much. Thank you so much. After a few minutes.